Blog Talk Radio.
It's time to strap our boots on. This is the perfect day to die. Wipe the blood out of our eyes. In this life, there's no surrender. There's nothing.
Hello, folks, and thank you once again for coming to Bard's Logic Political Talk, part of the growing conservative conversation, and also part of the Patriot Journalist Network. And you can find the Patriot Journalist Network by going to www.patriotjournalist.com. Now you can also find Bard's Logic on the website by going to www.bardslogicpoliticaltalk.com. And once there, if you would mind going to the Give page, and I've got some wonderful organizations there that you could donate to. Most recently, I had Cancer Free Kids on, and where for only $10, you can send a little stuffed animal lion to a child who was recently diagnosed with cancer. And it's real easy to do. Just go to your phone and put in the text number 80100. That's 8100. And in the text, type lion and follow the instructions there. There might be some data fees associated with that, but check that out as well as the other organizations that you can find, Bard's Logic Political Talk. And also there's the Bard's Logic page on Facebook as well. Check it out. And so tonight we have some special guests on. Namely, we will have Amy Murray, who is running for city council in the city of Cincinnati. And Amy has extensive history of political involvement and passion for diving into the issues when it comes to making her city a better place to live and work. Her business experience includes 14 years in global business development, with much of her focus on Asia. She currently owns her own business and serves as a business consultant, enabling companies to fully develop their Japanese business. As past president of her neighborhood council, she worked closely with residents, businesses, and businesses to bring the city about positive change. And as a member of the city council and candidate, Amy has been committed to a more robust job creation and making a more business-friendly city. She's also an advocate for the taxpayer and believes the city should live within its means with a structural balanced budget. Fiscal responsibility, holding our leaders accountable, and keeping our neighborhood safe are key to her focus areas. Of course, folks, many of those things about her we've heard here on previous shows. And without further ado, I will bring in Amy. Thank you very much for coming to the show. How are you?
Good, Robert. Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Great, great. I'm glad you're here as well. And then later on, folks, we will have Timothy White, who is a political science professor at Xavier University, talking about the importance of local elections. And we know you only have limited time here with us tonight, Amy, and so I want to go ahead and just go straight into the interview questions, okay?
That would be wonderful.
Okay, great. And first, we'll start off with just please tell us why you decided to run for city council.
Well, absolutely. And as you said, my background, I'm a business person. I was with Procter & Gamble for 14 years. I heard that you're having a Xavier professor on next, and I actually taught an international marketing course at Xavier for 2 years, and I was president of my neighborhood council. So I had, at a local level, had been very involved in business and in our neighborhood issues that were going on. And about 4 years ago, I just recall, you know, I'd read the paper every day and I'd see what was going on in the city and with city council, and I was so frustrated. And I just thought that we were heading in the wrong direction. And with things like property tax increases and the streetcar and some other topics like that, I just thought we were in the wrong direction and said, you know what, I can do better. I want to make a difference. I'm going to run for city council. And I have two teenage boys. They are a sophomore and senior in high school. And I want Cincinnati to be a place that our kids want to stay in, or if they go away to college, that they want to return to, where it's a thriving city, downtown and the neighborhoods. and that it has great jobs, and that, you know, the tax base is fair, so the jobs are here, and the kids will want to come back or stay in Cincinnati and raise their families. So, you know, I really feel a passion of where Cincinnati will be in 5 or 10 or 20 years.
Certainly, and we want to see Cincinnati and of course, other cities turn out to what we've been seeing in Detroit.
Exactly.
Okay. And then secondly, we'll move on, is your website says you have an extensive, and I brought this up in the description of the show tonight, extensive history of political involvement. So if you could tell us, what are some of the types of activities that you've been a part of?
Sure. And, you know, it's funny because I've always been a person that feels very strongly that you should get involved and impact your neighborhood, impact your city, impact your school. So when I was at college, I went to Arizona State University, and I was student body vice president then. So that was kind of my first look into political involvement. And really, there was just making a difference for the students at the university. Then I went on to my business career and really worked in the business area. But as I mentioned before, I was involved with our neighborhood council. And in Cincinnati, there's 52 neighborhoods, and they all have their own neighborhood councils that deal with issues that impact that specific neighborhood. It could be blight, it could be zoning issues, it could be crime, development. Right now, you know, many of them are very concerned about the parking meter situation. And so I was very involved with our neighborhood council at that point. Then I ran for council 4 years ago, and as a first-time candidate, I came pretty close. And then when Chris Monzel was won the election for county commission in 2010, I was appointed to his seat on council and was on Cincinnati City Council in 2011, and really enjoyed that year on council. People had tried to put through a property tax, and we were able to stop it. And, you know, we were just able to do some really good things during that time period, but there wasn't enough time. And I'm looking forward to getting back onto City Council and being able to positively impact the city.
Well, definitely, because it's not, you know, my opinion and others, that it's not more spending we need or no more taxes we need or spending. It's cuts, you know. And that's why they want to raise those taxes to just keep on spending and spending. But that's a topic for another night. We could go on at length about
so
that. I'm sure we can. So we'll move on. Now, as the president of the neighborhood council, you want to give some more elaboration on how you brought some positive change?
Sure. And I had been on our council for about 8 years. And so, you know, a lot of this is the unglamorous, you know, it's not very sexy work of just keeping your neighborhood strong. And so a lot of things we did with neighborhood council were zoning issues. You know, if depending on different properties that were wanting to come up into the city, is working on those. Some of the key issues that we worked on really were helping the Hyde Park Business District, and really working with them to have a vibrant business district. And, you know, and that involved even small things like there's a corner cafe there, and they did not have outside seating and wanted outside seating, and for the coffee shop there. And, you know, this was a good 10, 15 years ago, and, you know, we worked with the business district, and we worked with the neighbors and put outdoor dining at Hyde Park Square. And I think that's a cornerstone of what people love about being able to go to that area right now, is that you do have those options. And, you know, we did a lot of community involvement, things like a big 4th of July party and celebration, and, you know, to celebrate, you know, America, to celebrate our country. And, you know, it just brought together all the people in the neighborhood. So there were a lot of different things that we worked on. Some were political, some were not, but it was really doing what's best for your neighborhood, working with the police, you know, when there was crime issues going on. And luckily in this area, a lot of the crime was petty crime, breaking into cars at night and things like that. So it was really letting the residents know what's going on and what they can do to help it and to prevent themselves from being a victim of a crime.
Okay, great. And, you know, normally, of course, for the audience who comes in here on a regular basis, we normally cover, you know, national issues, both the local elections coming up, And they definitely are important, and we'll be talking about that later here and with our other guest on this evening about, you know, how it is the foundation, you know, towards and even in some ways a buffer against, you know, the federal government. So,
yes.
You
exactly.
know, that's why they're so important.
Well, and the neat thing in Cincinnati is with the 52 neighborhoods, and of course we have all the suburbs, so with those 52 neighborhoods, every single person can be a part of their community and impact it. They all have monthly meetings, and people are encouraged to come. And, you know, in some areas they might be having a lot of crime issues, so they need people there to speak up and to represent the neighborhoods. Or, you know, in other areas there might be issues of blight. You know, and this is your voice to speak up, and we're lucky that we have that in the city.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm bringing it back to the community involvement. I mean, and that's where it starts, and once you get in, you know, folks used to, you know, community experience, and they can bring that on to the next level and getting more involved, you know, politically, and that's important. So I think a lot of folks, unfortunately, you know, just the way things are, where we're so busy just making a living, it's hard to, you know, get out there and try to make a difference in other ways. You know, but once you get in and you get away from, like, you know, I always rail against watching reality shows. You know, people spending time doing that. But then just to get used to being, you know, having that involvement. Go ahead.
Oh, and that's so true, and I can't emphasize that enough, because with many of these community councils, you know, even if you're not on the council, but, you know, many of these, East Price Hill and Westwood and Mount Lookout and Mount Washington and Bond Hill, they have vibrant councils. You go and there's 20, 30, 40 people there every month that are just anxious to know what are the issues and how they can help out. And, you know, I was a working woman, a mother, but felt it was really important that I needed to take an outward look at everything going on in the community. And I'd encourage everyone to do that if they can.
Well, I think that's a good segue to the next question, is that some of the qualities, knowledge, and experience, and definitely business is a very important experience, that sets you apart from the other candidates that you're running against.
Sure. And I think, you know, right now people are so frustrated at its Cincinnati City Council, and it's some of the qualities we're seeing on the council right now. We're not seeing transparency. People are making decisions kind of quietly, and I would say not looking at all sides of the issue, just looking at one side and really pushing away any opposition and not really looking at all things. So I think what sets me apart is I research every side of the issue and really look at what's the best thing for the city in the long term. My business background, absolutely. The Cincinnati Chamber of Commerce recently interviewed all candidates for city council individually for about 30 minutes. There were about 15 to 20 business folks that interviewed them, and they ranked the candidates on 5 different criteria of, like, fiscal responsibility. And they just released a scorecard yesterday, and I was really honored and humbled that they gave you on these 5 different areas a green, you know, if you met their needs and goals and kind of were what they felt was the ideal situation. And I was very lucky. I received greens on all 5 areas and was the only candidate to have done that. So I wish there were more candidates that had 5 green. And because we need more business-focused candidates running for Cincinnati City Council and being on the council. And part of that is, if we have a healthy business community that's growing jobs and it's employing folks and people have jobs, then we're able to provide the services and, you know, the basic essentials that we need to in the city. If we don't have strong job growth, we're not able to do that. So I think what I bring to council is my strong business background. I also was an economics major in college, and with our pension issues and budget issues, that we have to take care of that. We must balance the budget, and we have to take care of this huge pension debt that we have right now. And I feel that I can bring some of that fiscal responsibility to council, and I'm not afraid to make the tough decisions. I think we have many council members right now that don't want to make the tough decisions, and they just want to keep the can on the road. They do, and just to do whatever is easiest and doesn't make people upset with them. But, you know, we've seen how that works in Detroit. If you keep doing that, eventually you're going to end up in big trouble. And the city just recently went down in our bond rating. And, you know, that's outrageous. People should be livid about that. I mean, that's the wrong direction for the city to be heading fiscally. And, you know, a frustrating part is, I think it was last May, the city all of a sudden found $14 million more dollars in earnings.
That frustrates people all the time. They want to get more money, and then they find it.
Yeah, so they found it, and I'm like, so you've, that's a whole other topic in itself of why don't you have better forecasting and to know what money's going to be coming in. But on top of that, this money, no one even said anything about maybe we need to put it towards the pension. Maybe we need to put it towards the deficit. Instead, it was just spent. And, so we really need some strong fiscal responsibility down at City Hall to manage our taxpayer dollars better.
Yeah, and there's a lot of places throughout the country, including the federal government, where pensions and deficit spending is atrocious, and a lot of them are in a lot of trouble. And so I'm going to move on here to, and you mentioned this earlier about the experience, and I want to elaborate on it, where you have been endorsed by the Charter Committee of Greater Cincinnati and the Home Builders Association. Why do you believe that those two endorsements are important?
That is a great question, and for people that might not be familiar with the Charter Committee in Cincinnati, I think it's one of the oldest, if you will, independent political parties in the country, and it's the charter system based on our city charter, and this is a really strong organization in the city, a very very strong folks that are interested in good government, fiscal responsibility, and they have been stronger at certain times during their history, and right now they decided, you know what, we want to cross-endorse candidates instead of just having candidates that are only charter committees. And after a long interview process, they had decided to cross-endorse me as a charterite. And I think that that's really important because for many reasons. I think the charterite represents a lot of good government and fiscal responsibility and should be taking a larger role in things going on in the city because they're kind of the watchdogs of, you know, is government being transparent? And, you know, for me personally to get that endorsement was kind of a stamp of, you know, we appreciate what you're doing, we recognize your fiscal responsibility, and I think it's a stamp of good approval, if you will, for kind of the many independents in the city of Cincinnati. And, you know, for the home builders, and some of the other endorsements have not come in yet. We're still having interviews with a lot of different groups right now. But with the home builders, that's really important because, I mean, it's all economics. We need home builders to be building homes, and we need people to be moving into the city, and we need to have a thriving economy. And so for them, you know, after doing questionnaires and discussions to be endorsed by them, you know, it's really positive, and it's positive for the campaign because it lets people know these folks that have interviewed her extensively have found, you know, that she's really this pro-jobs person.
Awesome. Well, that's good. That is definitely something I learned tonight. I did not know that. And I'm going to bring something in from one of our folks here in the chat when you're talking about blight. And
yes.
Tessa, thank you very much for your comments. And she says, blight is often code speak for government involvement and depriving people of their property rights through the use of eminent domain. And I certainly would love to have a long conversation with you about those things. But, you know, hopefully we'll be able to get you back on the show at some point.
Yeah,
I know you'll be really busy as time goes on campaigning.
That's great.
So.
And just to address that, there's just some parts in certain neighborhoods in town, because I certainly believe that people have the right to their own property to take care of it. But with all the foreclosures that have gone on when people have just left properties, and so now people are breaking windows at those properties, the grass is overgrown, you know, that's specifically what I was talking about. And just with all the foreclosure issues, we are seeing that in the city.
Right. And I think she was on board. I mean, I know Tessa, she's one of our regulars to the show, and I definitely think she's on board with you. And you actually, through that, answered one of my, actually, which was going to be my next question about Detroit and the accountability and balanced budgets. So we'll go on to the next one. Is with city council consisting of, you know, seven Democrats essentially, one Democrat and one Republican, why does this make your election to the council vital to the city's residents?
Well, exactly. As you said, there's seven Democrats, one independent, and one Republican. And the one Republican on council, will Charlie Winburn, will run this year and will most likely win, but he will be term limited off after this four-year term. So what makes this election so important is this is the first year that council races will be for 4 years. And so that is a long time for people to make either really good or really bad decisions. I think that you need to have tension in the system. Right now we're seeing with seven Democrats on council, there's a strong voting block of five or six that just vote the way that, you know, I'm assuming the mayor tells them, and you never see anyone differentiating or, you know, going outside of that block. And I think that does a disservice to the city and to the residents here and taxpayers and businesses. Because any issue that comes up, you should be able to have a hearty discussion. You should be able to have some opposition, because it makes everything better when you have people that say, gosh, have you thought about this? And you know, the public has a right to know. And so I think part of it is we have to have a more balanced city government, or we're just going to end up with people thinking the same way and not really vetting the issues that should be vetted if you had other Republicans or independents on that push back and that also love the city but say, hey, have you thought about it this way? You know, the other thing is I think we're in big trouble with this streetcar, and the current council strongly supports it. And, you know, right now I think it's up to $130 million. I've heard $150 million for 3 miles, which is $50 million per mile. And if you like the streetcar or not, it's just to the point now where we can't afford it. The city cannot afford the streetcar, and the costs are still going to go up. And, you know, with our pension issues, I just don't see any way you can manage the pension issues and have the streetcar. You know, we're just at a point where we can't do both of those. And I think our current city council wants to move forward. So I think we need to get other fiscal conservative people on council so that we can make a change and hopefully be able to stop the streetcar. I heard one of the other council members mention the other day that they're looking forward to phase two of the streetcar, which is taking it up to the UC area. And that would be at a price tag of about $200 million. And we just can't do that. I mean, I agree. We need to connect these parts of town. And, you know, I think a trolley would do just fine if it's for transportation. You know, if it's a transportation need, let's do something like the tank that they do in northern Kentucky and really be able to move people around. So I just think our current council has us in the wrong direction. And, we have strong voting blocks, and I don't feel like people – feel like they're being heard at City Hall these days, and that they really have no say because it's just a block and that's how they're going to vote.
Right. We're definitely going to be touching more on that subject in the bottom half into the of the show from about 10:30 to 11 when we bring on the professor. And if you're able to stay for parts of that, that's fine. If not, completely understand. I know you've got a lot going up, gearing up as the election moves on. So what are the think that Bard's Logic main focus is on the grassroots. What do you think is important for folks to get involved in local elections, and what is its significance and impact?
Well, and I think it's important for everyone to get involved in local elections, and maybe because I have two teenage sons, I really work hard to get high school students and college students involved in the campaign. Tonight we had two separate candidate forums, and at one I had 10 students there. They were out for the forum for my campaign, students from Schroeder High School in Walnut Hills and St. Ursula Villa in Clark. And I think it's so important for these young people to start to see the community involvement, civic engagement, because we can make a difference in many different levels of the city. And so I just think it's important for people to get involved. And, you know, if someone says, well, it's a city election, I don't know if I can have much say, you know, elections are won and lost by a couple votes all the time. And so we need people that if they're frustrated with what's going on in the city to say, you know what, I'm going to get involved. And I mean, it starts with going out and voting and being knowledgeable about who you're voting for. And, you know, I hear people grumble, our property tax has gone up twice in the last 2 years. Well, you know what, if you're upset with it, then send notes out to your friends and say, hey, I've looked at these candidates. They're not going to raise our property tax. We need to get out and support them. You know, get out and pass literature. I mean, right now is critical for Cincinnati for the next 4 years. We need every person that wants a change, that's not happy about this streetcar, that's not happy about leasing our parking meters and increasing our parking rates and hours of operations, to get involved right now and have a say. And you can make a difference. And we need everyone out there to make a difference.
And I think that, not only that, there where you can actually make a greater impact getting involved with local politics than you can, you know, federally. And the way things are going with the federal government, I think it's more important for people to get involved locally. And, of course, you know, folks, you know, move up through the ranks, you know, so to speak, through the levels by starting at the local level. But I only see we got a little bit of time left, so I want to get through a couple of questions here, and then, you know, we'll go and see if where we go from there. But why do you think it is important for folks not living in your city to follow and support your campaign?
Oh, that's a great question, Robert. And it's interesting because when we've tracked at least people that support, whether it's financially or being involved, probably a good 60% of folks that support my campaign don't actually live in the city, but they may work in the city or they live in the surrounding communities. And it's so much what happens in the city of Cincinnati impacts everyone in Hamilton County and beyond. If you look at things like MSD, the Metropolitan Sewer District, we are under a government decree that we must fix parts of our sewer district. And this is going to be at a price tag of $3 or $4 billion over the next period of time. And so it's $3 or $4 billion. And this is going to go to everyone, so it will be split up between all of the taxpayers and in Hamilton County and beyond, and there's no way out of that. However, Cincinnati City Council, they manage Metropolitan School Sewer District, and the county commissioners, the county owns it. And so the city decided that for this project, this huge project, that pretty much what they did is made it that the only people that could bid on it are unions. They said you have to have this 5-year apprentice program, which is really only unions. And so part of it is by only allowing one certain group to bid on it, you're going to raise the costs. There's no doubt about it. I've heard estimates of as high as $1 billion to raise the cost. Second is a lot of the people that would want to bid on it that can't are minority-owned or women businesses because they're not parts of unions. And, you know, we want to let everyone have an equal opportunity to bid on this type of job. But what's going to happen is the decision of city council is going to impact the ratepayers in Hamilton County, not just in the city, because all of our bills will go up even more because of these poor decisions. So there's many things that the city decides on that impacts people directly and indirectly. You know, you look at what happened in Detroit, and that's affecting all of Michigan. And
Well, and I'd like to add that even folks, you know, who may not be in another, who may be in another, you know, state, not even Ohio, may not even be in Ohio, would be interested in your campaign because we just talked about it earlier. I mean, look at the composition of the city council, you know, when there's, you know, seven, you know, especially for, you know, folks who are more on the conservative side, you know, there's seven Democrats, and, you know, if you're going to have some support to a place that really could use some conservative thinking and not have those blocks, it definitely sounds like Cincinnati City Council could surely need that.
Well, and it's interesting. The Cincinnati Inquirer recently had a story on the council race, and one of their experts made a statement and said if the Republican – something to the effect of if the Republican Party hopes to have a future or a say in the future in the city, Amy needs to get elected.
I think I would agree with that statement. I really do.
Well, and because we need to get another seat on council and then continue to grow and have good government. And, you know, if we lose all our seats, then we're going to be in trouble. The whole city and county will.
I agree. And I do see it's about, we made it. I do see it's about the bottom of the hour, about 10:30. I just wanted to make sure I got everything in and the time you had allotted. So I just, you know, so I hope I didn't feel like I was pushing or rushing you on any of your answers. I just want to make sure that we were able to get everything in the timeline that I was told that you had tonight. So,
No, that is perfect. And do you mind if I give out my web address and Facebook for anyone that might want to look into this further?
Oh, no, perfect. No, actually, that was going to be the one of the last questions, if there's anything else you wanted to add.
Oh, well, if anyone wants to go and look at my webpage, I would really appreciate it. It's www.electamymurray.com. That's electamymurray.com, and I have a Facebook that's also Amy Murray, and would just appreciate anyone going on if you want to get involved with the campaign. Go and pass out literature, work the polls on election day, contribute, anything. We would love your support and really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much, Amy. We'll appreciate that. And we'll also put a link there to the Bard's Logic page, and I'll also be putting a link on the website as well.
That is perfect. Thank you so much, Robert, and thanks for all you do. Really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you very much for coming on to the show. And it's Amy Murray running for City Council of the City of Cincinnati, Ohio. Thank you very much, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye, thanks.
Bye-bye. Okay, that was great that she was able to come on to the show. And so what I'd like to do at this time is to bring on our panelists before I call our next guest. And I believe this is James. James, is this you?
Yes, it is. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you very much, James. And then I believe we have one of our other panelists, Cindy, on the line as well. Cindy?
Hello.
Hello. Well, it was great. I wish you guys had the opportunity to, to be able to maybe ask Amy some questions, but I know I want to keep things in with her timeline, and then we'll I hope she don't we rushed her, but I did have the other guest on. Maybe I could have made it later, but I was explicitly told that she'll be able to give us a half an hour. So what do you guys think? You think rushed her? I hope.
No, I don't think so. Seemed like she got out what she was looking to.
That's good. Well, I'll tell you what, I've got to actually make the call to our next guest. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to put on a brief song by Aubrey Ashburn, and while I connect with him, with Dr. White, I should say, and enjoy the song. You can hear more of her music by going to www.aubreyashburn.com. I shall return shortly. By Aubrey Ashburn, and we do have our other guest on this evening, Dr. White. Thank you very much, Dr. White, for coming on the show. How are you?
Very good. Thanks for having me.
Great. And we also have on with us tonight, we have two of our panelists here on Bard's Logic, and that is Cindy, and we have James. Gentlemen and gentle sir, say hello.
Hello.
Good to see you. Hear you.
Exactly. Well, great. Well, tonight we had a candidate on for city council, and she was talking about Helena's running for a city position and things of that nature on the show. And one of the things we talked about is we heard about how she believes elections are important, local elections are important in getting the younger folks involved, you know, in civic involvement. And the first question I'd like to ask you, Dr. White, is do you agree with that statement? Is there anything you'd like to add on why local elections are important?
Well, they're accessible for everyone, but especially for people who are entering into a political world. When you look at national campaigns or even statewide campaigns, they require a level of fundraising and name recognition that people who are just entering the political world can't have. So what's great about local elections is that people who are younger, who may not have much political experience at all, and who may not have a proven ability to fundraise for campaigns, can enter the political arena. It also allows young people to explore the possibility of public service to see if that's something that either they're interested in or good at. So it's a real training ground for politicians that might move on to higher level office in the American system.
Yeah, we briefly touched on that as well. Now, well, one of the things we were talking about the local politics, and she talked about how her her campaign is significant, at least for the city, is because the composition of the city council is pretty much mainly one party, and there's just a few, you know, there's nine members of the city council, and seven of those are the same party, creating a pretty strong voting block. And she's, you know, of course, of one of the other parties that are involved, and she thought it's important, you know, it makes more significant that, you know, she actually would gain seat there because she can bring another voice into, I guess, the debates so that, you know, some of the issues, or all the issues rather, would be better vetted, you know, during the council meetings, you know, when they're talking about, you know, passing laws and doing budgets and things of that nature. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, we see throughout the Midwest in the United States, and Cincinnati is a pretty good example of a demographic process where conservative and more Republican-leaning voters tend to be moving to suburbs or exurbs, they're called, and the inner core of cities are increasingly Democratic. And that's been going on in some ways for a long time. There was a process on the initial wave of many immigrants coming to cities that became Democratic. But Cincinnati has seen this definitely the last 20 years since I lived here, and the exurban counties that surround Hamilton County, Butler, Warren, and Claremont, have grown in population and become sort of a hotbed for former Hamilton County residents to move to for many reasons, but primarily taxes, which tends to be a very large motivation for many of these Republican-leaning voters.
And excuse me. And what of where she's talking about the voting block, where, you know, it seems like it's, you know, let's say if the mayor, for instance, and she mentioned if the mayor was a Democrat and then most of the other, you know, the people in the city council are the same, that, you know, pretty much whatever the mayor wants to get done pretty much is rubber stamp. Now, she didn't say rubber stamp.
Right.
But, you know, with that, there being such a strong voting block where, you know, a lot of the talk about the different issues is sometimes even done behind closed doors, so to speak, that really actually is a detriment to the residents of the city.
Well, I think part of the problem that might be she might be referring to is that in Cincinnati, council members run for votes throughout the entire city. Other metropolitan areas or urban areas have districts or wards. So even if one party dominates the overall electoral group that's in the city politics, because they represent very different districts, they have very different competing interests, so that there is no sense of unanimity that's here. There probably is de facto, and I'm not an expert enough on all the where all the votes for all the different Democrats who win comes from, but my guess is that different candidates have different strengths in different neighborhoods here and rely in some cases more in this neighborhood or another candidate might rely on another neighborhood more. I don't follow local politics enough here to know that, but there is a tendency in a single district system that Cincinnati uses that there isn't as strong an identification with the local area, obviously, as if you broke up the city into wards like many cities do and have distinct electoral districts that candidates run from, because then they really are trying to work on the problems or issues of that particular neighborhood that they come from, which might be very distinct from another neighborhood.
And one of the things we focus on here on the show is, you know, the grassroots and grassroots, you know, involvement and significance. And how can we tie in, you know, I like to tie in, you know, the importance of the grassroots or how important local politics is for the grassroots.
Well, I think local politics is the place where grassroots politics really works and really matters, because the number of scale of votes is relatively small. Politicians can actually canvass neighborhoods and local elections, so they get to know the neighborhoods, they get to meet people, they get to hear people's concerns, the actual voters and constituents. It also allows people in their neighborhood to organize and have block parties and other forms of small-scale political gatherings and representation. So I think it allows democracy to work in the smallest possible context. In a big, vast country like the U.S., our local elections really allow us to organize ourselves for local issues. And there's a long tradition of this U.S. in the U.S. going back to New England town hall meetings that started well over two centuries ago. Hello?
Hello, I'm here.
Sorry. So I think that that tradition of allowing local people to participate in helping to meet candidates, run candidates, sponsor, or promote a local candidate in their neighborhood is something that's very powerful in promoting people's interests. And we talked earlier about young people, but I know many of my students at Xavier are heavily involved in these local races and are often given quite Hello?
I'm here.
Okay, sorry. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we hear you fine.
Yep,
mm-hmm. Okay.
I hear you just fine.
So that's where I think how local politics helps, in a sense, democracy at the grassroots level operate in its most pure form, because in many of these cases, even the big difference would be between in larger areas. The only way a politician will be known to the voters is through the modern mass media, so they have to rely on television. And you even see that in the logic of urban politics here in the race for mayor, where there will be more money spent based on trying to get larger numbers of votes, whereas city council elected officials need lesser numbers of votes than a mayor might need because there's only one person running. So it's a the more votes you need as a politician, the more likely you'll rely on modern mass media, which requires much larger fundraising. And in some ways, you're less likely to know all the different constituents you're representing.
And also, you mentioned earlier about the kind of impact the grassroots has on the, you know, the local level, how significant it is to local politics. Now, it sounds like that doesn't carry over where the grassroots are as effective on the federal level. Do you think that's so, and why?
Well, I think, you know, the federal elections, you know, if we're talking about congressional races, Senate races, and obviously presidential races, you're looking at a scale of votes which is hundreds of thousands, and logistically nobody can know and, you know, go around to enough meetings to have hundreds of thousands of constituents that they know on a personal level. It's just not humanly possible. So the only way to communicate effectively is through the modern media, and that can be through, you know, today, internet connections, but TV, radio ads. But it's not through the traditional personal kinds of politics where people got to know people on a family basis. And, you know, you need at least 100,000 votes to win most congressional districts, sometimes way more than that, and you need, you know, sometimes hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars to run. So it's a very different logic to the campaign.
Right, because, you know, we'd like to see more of a grassroots influence on, you know, more of the federal, on the federal level, and especially even during the primaries that we've seen and discussed here on the show, it seems like the grassroots are kind of losing more and more of that influence you know, during those types of elections, especially to larger interests and business and money and things of that nature.
Yeah, I mean, I think fundraising, you know, there's sort of been an unbelievably rapid increase in the amount of funds that are being spent on federal campaigns especially. And because of that, if the politicians are worried more about raising money, they're obviously spending less time at community centers or neighborhood meetings or other kinds of more traditional ways of getting to know who people were, their concerns, the issues that are most important to them, and how to best represent them once they would be elected. Instead, they are ultimately preoccupied with fundraising. And, you know, what is done with the funds isn't often effective communication with voters as much as it is, you know, just unbelievably attacking your opponent. And we've seen in just in the last few months, the few media sites that I've paid attention to, I've heard, you know, campaigns, commercials run by the Senate campaign in Kentucky just devastating an opponent, probably in some ways slightly altering at least the person's record and
mm-hmm.
putting them in the worst personal light, but no explanation of what the long-term incumbent senator's views are or policies are. Doesn't really inform the voter at all about what that person's issues are or what their concerns are. And in the mayoral race here, there was a TV ad that was run in which you didn't even really know who paid for the ad. They didn't even mention by name and verbally who paid for the ad. There was a slight notice at the bottom of the screen, but the ad just bemoaned the integrity of the opposing candidate, never talked about any public issue except that the other politician, of course, was corrupt and, you know, was terrible, and therefore you shouldn't vote for them. And that's really not, I mean, on one level, some people would see that as informing the public of, you know, how bad the other guy is or the other candidate is, but in the long run, voters would be better served, I think most people would believe, by understanding the political ideologies, issue positions that the candidates actually take. And those,
mm-hmm.
unfortunately, despite so much money being spent, that's not being communicated to the voters at all.
And a lot of the folks, excuse me, you know, on the grassroots would like to see more political and governmental influence from their local and state politics, almost as a buffer against, you know, the federal government. So how are local governments important in, do you think, creating such a buffer between the federal government and the states and local governments?
Well, local governments historically have solved unique local problems. They would be most important in issues like crime, education, often things like trash collection or environmental issues that are unique to a specific neighborhood or area. They can play a very positive role in economic development. We often focus on the role of the federal government and macroeconomic policy at the national level as somehow affecting the economy, but very wise, effective local government policies can attract businesses to locate in certain communities and neighborhoods. They can also help through tax incentives, building public parks, having excellent education systems, encourage companies not just to come but to stay and expand operations. Their development of infrastructure and public goods, like good public transportation, for example, might encourage people to live in a certain area and make it more worthwhile and economically feasible for people to live there. So there's lots of local policies that do really impact people's lives. And while I don't want to dismiss the important role of state as well as the national government in making policy, local governments do a lot of things. And cities that are well-governed or local areas, even in rural parts of the U.S., that are well-governed have, you know, dramatically different local circumstances. And, you know, you can see this from policing. So, you know, country or communities like New York City, for example, that had a long history of relatively high crime rates have seen dramatic declines in crime. And that's not due nearly as much to federal law or even New York state law as it was by local policies and efforts by local community groups to clean up their neighborhood, as well as politicians, police working together, trying to work with the local communities to get rid of violent crime and work on other kinds of issues which were seen to be a cause of crime in neighborhoods. So we've seen, you know, dramatic changes that have worked in certain communities and neighborhoods because of effective local government. So I don't think we should dismiss that its importance at all as being a partner for people at the grassroots level trying to solve the problems they experience every day.
Right, and then some, you know, something about, you know, buffer about like nullification, can get that one out. You know, there's talk about state nullifications of different, you know, if laws come down that a state doesn't agree with on the federal level. What kind of, you know, importance is that for a state to be able to do that?
Well, there's all kinds of reasons why that constitutionally is not likely to work. The Commerce Clause has been interpreted pretty broadly by the Supreme Court, so that almost anything that the federal government chooses to do can be said to affect interstate commerce.
That's true.
And the right to tax. I mean, even when Justice Roberts didn't consider the Commerce Clause a justification for the constitutionality of Obama's economic or health care policies, which do put rules upon states, he did recognize the power to tax is universal, that the national government has, and therefore the tax penalties that are part of Obamacare make it, therefore, a policy that the states can impose upon, the federal government can impose on states.
Mm-hmm.
Realistically, a lot of things which some states oppose in the end, because the federal government often helps to finance some of these programs, like Medicare, et cetera, that Medicaid, that it's in the state's interest to pursue it. That's why, in the end, you know, the federal government interest in helping promote increased access to health care will likely make many governors who historically or recently have claimed they won't support the implementation of Obama's policies probably will support it, because it's a way of helping get health care access to people who otherwise wouldn't have it in their states as well.
And what I'd like to do at this time, Dr. White, is open up to the panel here and see if we'll start with James, because I know you've been on hold the longest, and then Euston, if you have any questions for Dr. White. James?
Well, as far as, you know, local politics, I'll be honest, it's not something that, you know, that I've gotten involved in, and I would have to say in the biggest reason for that is, well, lack of information of, well, even where I would even go look to find out when something was, you know, an election was happening, for example, when city council elections were happening. I mean, I've lived all over the United States, and one thing that I've seen to be a common theme around the United States, I mean, I've lived in Arkansas, I've lived in Utah, I've lived in Massachusetts, I've lived in Oklahoma. And one common theme that I have noticed across the United States when it comes to local politics is they seem to like to isolate the information as to when this, you know, when this, you know, when these elections are occurring. And it makes me wonder if they don't do this somewhat intentionally to keep the voters within a limited group of people, well, basically of whom they want to vote. And
well,
so they get the results that they get the results that they want instead of perhaps the results that should happen.
Well, the biggest historical source of information on local politics was your local newspaper. And we've seen a dramatic decline in the last 10 years, especially of local neighborhood papers, as well as even urban dailies. Because really what distinguished these local newspapers, their purpose was to focus on local news. They didn't have staffs to have bureaus in state houses or obviously in Washington or around the world. So they saw their job as to provide news and information about local crime, education, obviously political races, these kinds of things, business development, et cetera. And I think it's there's really, I mean, I'm not an expert on how people use the Internet or get information, but my guess is that we've seen no effective replacement. As people read daily local newspapers less, there's going to be much less news that they gain about or information they gain about local elections. Clearly, if you're partisan affiliated, you could contact the local political party. They endorse candidates for local elections. And the nice thing about local elections is that all these local candidates are looking for volunteers and activists to support them. So there's plenty of opportunities to get involved that way. But it's, I think for the average citizen who doesn't have the interest or time to want to volunteer for a candidate or a party and just know how to intelligently vote on candidates, it is harder than it used to be because of the lack of information. There are some groups that try to inform voters and historically have done a fairly good job. It would depend obviously on each community how well they're organized, but groups like the League of Women Voters and others have historically have done a fairly good job of providing information. And I would say that when we look back, you know, over the last couple hundred years of American democracy, local newspapers did a wonderful job overall of providing information about candidates' backgrounds, often in minute detail, because often, you know, there's dog catchers, there's all kinds of other very localized offices with more than one candidate running, and often you could get quite good brief summaries from local newspapers. Newspapers used to publish voting guides, which would try to provide a brief summary of the candidates, their major positions on issues, et cetera. And these were, despite the editorial pages of newspapers being perhaps pro-Democrat or Republican, often these voting guides were quite fair and objectively organized by the local journalists. So unfortunately, those, I think, are dying as fewer and fewer people read daily newspapers, and if they read anything online to replace it, I don't think the stuff they're reading online focuses nearly as much on local elections or candidates or issues. And I think the long-term effect of that is very corrosive for local democracy, because it means, as James was saying, that in the end it's the people who have a huge stake in what the city government does. So it might be a big business who has a huge incentive to have something rezoned for their interest that may not be in the general public's interest at all, but they're going to be paying attention to that zoning issue or make sure the politicians do what they want, otherwise, and tell the politicians about it. And the general public wouldn't even know that that zoning issue is even coming up because they don't have a local newspaper that they regularly read to discuss those kinds of issues or read about them. So I'm afraid that's one area where the demise of the local newspapers really hurt our ability to inform voters about local issues in their communities.
Well, thank you very much, James, for chiming in on that question. So, Cindy, I want to open up the mic to you and see if there's anything you'd like to ask to Dr. White.
Okay, yeah. Thanks, Doctor. I'm glad you're here and you're having this discussion with us, because I have just recently discovered the importance of local politics and following what happens in your, you know, local area. James, I'm like you. I haven't done anything. I haven't been involved at all in local politics. All I do is vote in the general elections that come up, some primaries if I know the candidates. And I didn't really know about the candidates at all. I just voted straight party line. So
right.
I understand where you're coming from.
Yeah, and if you think about how people's partisan identification works, the issues that we tend to identify, make one identify as a Democrat or Republican, may have less to do with local issues that deal with, local education issues in the school boards, or how we should build more schools, or where should we have more schools, or should we focus more on special education, other kinds of local issues that may not be so easily identified as, you know, sort of the national political issues that tend to make people Democrats or Republicans in the U.S.
Exactly. I mean, I took my kids out of public school because I could see what was going on in my kids' classroom. And But the thing is, I never bothered to go to a Volusia County School Board meeting to find out, you know, if there's something I could do to change anything. I just jerked my kids out, and I've been homeschooling or private schooling ever since.
Right,
and now I'm homeschooling my grandkids. But I am learning, and I got involved after the 2008 election with that debacle with McCain. I started paying a little more attention, and by the time the 2010 election came, and then in 2011 when people were starting to gear up for the presidential election, I got very interested in trying to help Newt Gingrich get nominated in the Republican Party. And whether you, you know, agree with me on Newt or not, which I think he would be the best thing that ever happened to this nation, but whether you agree with that or not, the thing that I learned in the middle of all that was there was a lot more I needed to know about what was going on locally. And that happened because a guy named Eddie Stam was sitting at a card table at the voting place where I vote. And I was there with my Newt Gingrich signs. And he came up to me and he says, "Well, hey, well, who are you working with? How come I don't know you?" Because, you know, he was, you know, very involved in the Republican Party and the Republican Party clubs and all that.
Right.
And I said, "Well, I'm just here just because I like Newt Gingrich, and I've been working for his campaign. I don't know anybody in this county in the Republican Party." He goes, "Oh, you mean you don't know Tony Ledbetter, don't you?" "No, I don't know Tony Ledbetter." And so he's like, you know, "Well, you got to come work with us." And that's what he was there for. He had his little table set up with a pad of paper, and it was a volunteer sheet, and you could volunteer, put your name, put your address, your email, and check off the boxes of the kinds of things you would get involved with to help in local election. So I did that. And then I got involved with them. Then I found out what was going on in our county through them, because I went to Republican Club meetings and REC meetings, joined the REC, and then I was able to learn more about what's going on. And as a result of that, I started setting up debates. I set up the county council debates. And you're running for city, right?
Yeah, Dr. White.
I think your example of how you got involved is quite common. You know, one particular election per political personality. You know, I remember years ago I knew of someone who ended up running for the U.S. Senate because she initially got involved with how trash was being taken out in her neighborhood. And that got her involved in that level of politics, and she ran for the local government issue and got in local government and then ultimately in county government and then ran for a Senate seat. So it's often, you know, a citizen's interest in some issue, some political personality, and the more they get involved, the more they realize what's going on. And I think democracy requires sort of the active participation of the public, because if citizens don't participate, then only those who are already on the little sheet of activists are the ones who are making the policy and influencing the politicians. So I think it's, you know, great that you're involved in listening. You know, and sometimes political parties get used to having the same names on the clubs forever, and they kind of atrophy. They they don't get any new people, new ideas, new blood. And we know that, you know, the political world that we live in is in a democracy is one where generations move on, they pass on, they live their lives, and the older cohort dies off, and then they're replaced by newer ones, and it's a constant process of change. And even among some voters who their party identification may remain the same, their views on certain issues may change, and even if their views don't change, there's new issues that emerge that need to be addressed by the government or by politicians, and they have to come up with policies regarding those. So the political world needs a constant infusion of new people, new ideas, in order to deal with the different kinds of issues. And if you've lived long enough, you realize how the sort of the political world, and it's not just the nature of competition between parties changes, but the actual issues that government has to deal with and how we conceive of these issues changes. So what it means even to be a Democrat or Republican today is quite different from 20, 30, or 50 years ago.
Well, and that's for certain. We're definitely seeing that today, and we actually discussed that, you know, kind of at length here where, you know, and I think that's what brings it back to the importance of local elections is in some people and some of the folks you've called into the show, not necessarily our panelists, but, you know, other folks who've, you know, the audience who've called in, you're getting of the mind where, you know, on the federal level, the two parties, and we might even talk about this briefly the last time, or, you know, some of the last time you're on the show, Dr. White, is that the two parties seem to be, at least in the federal level, getting so close and close together, as some of the audience members talk about, that, you know, it's getting to be they're almost like one party, you know, one mind. And so the only way to set buffer against that is to
given the debate in Washington these days about the continuing resolution and funding the federal government, I'm not sure at this point it's easy to see they think things are the same. But I understand the general point, but that's been a historic reality in American politics because most Americans historically have been toward the middle of a political spectrum on the right or left or moderate or liberal or conservative. And as long as there's a sort of a vast majority of people who are in the middle, we would expect the parties to end up close to there because if they end up going to an extreme, then they're going to let the other party have all the middle and they'll lose.
And do you think, you know, and some folks, you know, there seems to be a growing, you know, a growing apathy where, you know, folks, well, I think it's between apathy and, you know, folks are just so busy, you know, trying to take care of their own that they just can't get involved the way that they used to politically. I just think that there's a lot less, I mean, perhaps I'm wrong, but I just feel like I see a lot less political involvement by folks. And as I said, even to a point where there's, you know, even some apathy where they feel like, you know, there's really nothing I can do. So they just, you know, don't really get involved. And I think, you know, bringing them back to getting involved in local politics would be important. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm not an expert on measuring all the different ways of thinking about how people are involved in politics. But I know in voting, we've stabilized our historic decline, and I think it's actually spiked up slightly from where it was 15, 20 years ago, that in the last couple election cycles, last few election cycles, we're getting slightly more voters than we used to. Some people think that that's because of the Obama effect of getting a larger number of minority voters to vote than historically would have been has been the case in recent elections before him being on the ballot. And clearly there was a huge difference between the 2008 and 2010 electorates. If you look at the electorates that, you know, that swept the Tea Party and winning so many Republican seats in 2010, that was a very different voting population than that which elected Obama or reelected him, for that matter.
You mean those voters that don't really have a legal right to vote?
Basically, black and brown
those
voters.
Ones you mean?
Black and brown voters just didn't show up in near the same numbers in 2010 as they did in 2008 and 12. In fact, I think in 2012, it was a record that there was actually a higher rate of black voter participation than white voters. We've never seen that in American history, I don't think, because that's partly the legacy of slavery and all the Jim Crow laws that were in effect that prevented blacks from voting. Until the Voting Rights Act. But even after the Voting Rights Act was in effect, blacks voted at significantly lower rates than whites. But I think blacks constitute 12% of the overall population, but they were 13% of the electorate in 2012. So they were slightly overrepresented in the voting public, which we hadn't seen before.
Can I ask you something? I want to ask you a little while ago, real quick, Cindy, I want
to be able to bring, you know, like the, you know, equal things that are. So I'd like to give James the opportunity and then come back with that. And real quick before we go on, I didn't quite get how much time you would have for us tonight, Dr. White, so I don't want them to keep you too much later.
Yeah,
than
not too much past 11, if that's okay.
Okay, yeah, because it's about 10 after right now, so
okay.
So James, if you get something real quick and then
sure.
And then you and that,
I would
get going. So.
You know, kind of on it, I'll just keep it really just as brief as I can here, since we just running short on time. I would have to say that a lot of the reason that, I've been sitting here thinking while you talk, and I think I would have to say that there's a lot of reason that, and I could be incorrect in this, but you mentioned apathy and voter apathy, and we look at the rampant corruption that goes on in our nation's capital, and you couldn't help but wonder if voting hasn't done anything to correct what's going on there, what good is it going to do to vote on a local level when our national politics are so corrupt and they're just going to do whatever they want, whether it's legal or not? And, so if your local town isn't, basically sovereign from the decisions of the federal level, if they're going to pass a law that dramatically affects you on the local level, what would be the point? And I think until we can get the corruption, and I'm not specifying party, don't get me wrong, don't misunderstand me, it's bad on both sides. Rampant corruption, lobbyists basically owning our congressmen, and without the state sovereignty that this country nation was founded on, as long as we have federal supremacy, I think until we have the sovereignty returned to the individual states that was intended by the founding fathers, I really can't help but think that involvement in local politics will just simply begin to dwindle until it's just a tiny minority of the voting population in those cities.
Well, we do know that people who have a long sense of attachment to where they live are more likely to be involved in their local politics. And you talked before about how your experience, you've moved from several states, and that's becoming a much more common pattern as people don't have a job for a long career with one company in one location. They migrate for jobs, if nothing else. And because of that, you don't have that long sense of multiple generations, perhaps even linked to a certain neighborhood or community. And it's not as likely you would understand. You would know other people. You wouldn't have as big a stake in a neighborhood or community if you're relatively new to it. You don't know that many people there, et cetera. And I think that's a really big threat to people being motivated. I don't know if apathy is the right word, but apathy sort of assumes at one point you were interested and you're not. But if you're brand new to a neighborhood and you're too busy with a new job to pay much attention to what's going on with the local school board or neighborhood development council or whatever that is occurring in your area, you just don't pay attention. And because you've always voted in federal elections, probably, you're more likely to continue to vote for when presidential elections come around, or maybe for Senate or Congress or something like that, because they're seen as bigger offices. So in terms of the supremacy issue, I think that it's an interesting reality in that while you can argue that the federal level politicians, because they need to fundraise, are so beholden to different interest groups that pay for their campaigns, they are more scrutinized by the media and by the opposition parties, so that if they do violate federal spending laws or other kind of campaign laws, they can be easily prosecuted, or if not prosecuted, at least in the media, exposed. Whereas local politicians, actually, because less people are paying attention to them and there's not many investigative journalists investigating what's going on with the county council's budget as there is the federal budget, there's actually a greater potential for politicians to commit corrupt acts of using the public treasury for their own private purposes at the local level, just because of the lack of scrutiny. So it's an interesting dynamic. These politicians aren't as personally at the local level in need of large donors to run their campaign, so they're not owned necessarily by lobbyists or interest groups that way. But if they're unscrupulous, they might be less easy to be detected. And there's great examples of that. I think the last week it was exposed that the athletic director at Northern Kentucky University ran up $300,000 on a Kroger card or something. I mean, crazy stuff like that where you would think
a lot of groceries.
You know, buying grocery cards or something. I mean, it's crazy. So I'm just saying, why is it? It's because not many media are probably checking out the expense accounts of Northern Kentucky University employees compared to, you know, every congressman and senator. If they're going to run, they'll have people investigating their financial backgrounds to make sure they pay their taxes and that they don't have any kind of financial irregularities. So that part of sort of national politics is kept cleaner. But I do accept your point. I think it's an interesting and valid one that to run for federal office, either you have to be extremely wealthy or basically, you know, make friends with a lot of wealthy people. And most of us who, if somebody gives you a lot of money and then they give you a phone call, you feel like you have to answer that phone call. That's just, they buy access. There's no doubt about it.
And Cindy, I know what it's quarter after, so before we move on, I want to make sure that that you know he's okay for one more if he's got to go. So
sure,
what
sure.
Do you think
so I'll take one more question, and I have to go. But thank you so much.
Well, I appreciate it, Dr. White. Thank you very much for coming on the show, and I appreciate you coming on again. So go ahead, Cindy.
Oh, thank you, Dr. White. Earlier you mentioned something about, you know, that running for local offices kind of gives you name recognition if you ever want to run for anything else higher up the line. And I was just thinking that Obama was not recognized at all. I mean, nobody knew who Obama was. And this seems to be a general happening in the Democrat Party. They have these voting blocks. They have blocks of people. And they're like groups that the muckety-mucks, the uppity-ups in the Democrat Party can go to those people and they can say, okay, this is the guy that is going to represent what you and I believe, and you just need to vote for him. You need to endorse him, and you need to give your money, you know, give us that big kick.
Same thing happened with Romney, too, but go ahead.
Right, exactly. Well, Romney had some, at least he had some name recognition, but Obama is the epitome of somebody who was ushered into his position by big money and big power. And it seems to me that conservatives in local areas need to sort of build these power brokers. You know, we need to pick up the phone and make a call to certain donors and certain blocks of power, and you say, okay, and I'm talking about like community organizations, political clubs, executive committees, people like that. You got to have like a group, you know, these groups of conservatives all throughout your county or your city.
The Tea Party has kind of done that, don't you think?
Well,
in a way, but I'm talking about even bringing the Tea Party into this whole group. I'm talking about taking, like in our county, we've got the conservative people here, the groups are, you got a Republican club in almost every county region, okay, you got a zone. Then you've got we've got a Tea Party group called Spruce Creek Patriots. We've got the 912 groups. We have two 912 groups here. And, you know, so if you had like a line of communication between all of these, plus we have some overpasses people now that have come on board. And so if you take all these people and you say you do a radio spot for advertisement, or even a newspaper spot, and you say, this candidate is endorsed by blah, 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 all these groups, the
right.
Republican Club of West Volusia, the Republican Executive Committee, blah, 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 then the people know who they're voting for. Otherwise, in this county, nobody knows anything about their local candidate. Don't you think that we ought to be building the same kind of, a circuit where information can be passed around?
Well, political parties historically have done this, and you sort of mentioned it. I know that when here in Cincinnati that you may criticize how many Democrats are on city council, but different Democratic candidates vie to be officially endorsed by the Democratic Party. so that even though there are more Democrats running than are endorsed by the Democratic Party, they all wanted to have that official endorsement so that the voters would know the Democratic committee of the Hamilton County or the city of Cincinnati agrees these are the best candidates that the Democratic Party thinks are the best for them. I think that, you know, a grassroots democracy for local office especially would allow voters to have some knowledge of who these people were beyond having relying on a party ID queue or a group of people or others endorse them. But I think in general, the reason why party identification is so powerful is because if people say, I think I'm a Republican because of these particular beliefs and values, somebody else who identifies and says, I'm going to run as a Republican, probably holds similar beliefs, so that just because you have the same party ID communicates from voter to the candidate and candidate to the voter, we share similar ideals. And in some ways, that's more true in America than ever before because there aren't as many liberal Republicans as there used to be. There's almost none. And there's many fewer conservative Democrats than there used to be. So the parties have become in that way more ideologically pure. So you sort of know where people are. Now, I would say that, you know, we're a big, diverse place with lots of different people, lots of different perspectives. And just because, you know, Obama says he's a Democrat, there's probably a lot of Democrats who disagree with him on this issue or that issue, just like you can name any Republican, John McCain or Ted Cruz or any of them, and say, well, I agree with him on that, and I disagree with him on that, even though I'm a Republican. So I think the logic of having some basis for voting without you as a individual political consumer, as a voter, having to find out personally who this person is and all of their, you know, political history and all their views on issues, party ID is a nice, neat, easy way of knowing that guy is better than the other guy because there's usually only two. And the one I'm going to vote for is the one who identifies with the same party I do. That's why it persists so powerfully. You know, we also have an election system where you only vote for one person. You know, and I think in the last time I talked with Rob here on this show that, you know, if you have a multiple candidate system where you can vote for more than one candidate, it forces the voter not to make such an easy choice of A or B. It's they can vote for, you know, a list or a number. And in the city council race here in Cincinnati, voters can do that in some ways. But it allows, when you get beyond just having to vote for either or, it's a more complicated process that requires the voter to think through how many do I really endorse? How many do I really want? How can I distinguish and show my preference for the different candidates that are on the ballot? So, but unfortunately, most American elections, if you want more choice and be able to express more preference, it's pretty simple. You're choosing A or B for most people.
Yeah, and I definitely like the system they have over there. We talked about last time we were here, the Irish system. I really like how they do elections there. I know we discussed it on the other show you were on.
Right.
I believe it was in December for folks who want to go and look up the archives, because the archives for that show is still available when we're talking about multi-party systems. And I just think it's a better way to vote. So,
and I think there's a few cities in the Northeast that use that system.
Oh, wow.
They do use a single transferable vote system for local elections, but it's relatively rare in the U.S. The system that Cincinnati uses allows voters to vote for more than one candidate, which provides, you know, some choice, but it's not the same as when you're able to rank order your preference.
Preference, right.
So, well, listen, Rob, it was great being on your show again, and keep up the good work.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank
it's
you,
great
Dr.
having
White.
You on again, and I look forward to talking to you
nice
some other time.
Nice with you guys, too. Take care.
Yeah, thanks
you
for,
too.
Thanks
take
for,
care.
Thanks for being here. I enjoyed it.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, folks, and that was Dr. White, Xavier University professor, and he's got a pretty impressive resume. I must say. And I'll just talk a little bit about it. He's was a visiting research fellow at the Moore Institute at the National University of Ireland in Galway. He has more than 40 publications that have focused primarily on politics in Ireland and has appeared in journals published in 11 different countries. And more than 25 of his nearly 70 conference papers have been presented at conferences outside of the United States. Some of Dr. White's most recent research has focused on analyzing the results of the 2011 Irish election, general election, and he's also taught courses covering the politics of war and peace. And he's also won the Teacher of the Year Award on Xavier's campus and also been nominated for the Carnegie National Teacher of the Year. And he's also won numerous grants for the college. So he's got a really impressive resume. So we have about 35 minutes of the live portion of the show. And what I'm going to do here is just go ahead and play a little bit of some music here while I close some things off from the last call, because I did have to do a three-way calling on there. And so I will be back very shortly. But for that time, and please, folks, stay on for the rest of the show. And we'll have another song here by, at least part of one, by Aubrey Ashburn. Enjoy. I know that didn't take very long, but I wanted to make sure that I wasn't holding up Dr. White's line, so I had to make sure I had that disconnected for him. So thank you very much for holding, and of course, if you'd like to listen to this in the archive, check out the other show that we had Dr. White on. I believe it was back in December when we were talking about multi-party systems and how, at least in my opinion, how that would actually benefit the United States political system and actually give better representation to the American citizenry. So we'll bring it back to you, James. So what we've heard so far tonight by Amy and by Dr. White, what's your thoughts?
Well, I would have to, as far as you mentioned multi-party, and it got my mind going really quickly, because that's something that I think that we need. But I really like I said, having had lived around various different locations in the United States, it really does seem that the problem that we're having, with local politics is, the federal politics intrudes so much into our daily lives, that I could understand why people would be apathetic, or I'm not sure if apathy is the correct word, but just simply don't even get that, to quote Hillary at this point, what difference does it make?
Yeah.
I hope she never lives that down. I hope she never does. I know I'll never forget it. Without a doubt, it's important to be involved, but I can understand why people would not be, because we hear on the news every day about this law and that law and a new law, and, that will affect us personally on a very local level. And And you know, one has to wonder just exactly, well, when have laws ever historically been a one-size-fit-all for 310 million people? And I would have to say, well, never. And, you know, something, a notion I've tossed around to you know, among friends and people I know that follow politics is, you know, maybe perhaps they should pass an amendment where if they pass a law, they have to get rid of another one. And to, you know, mitigate the, you know, the intrusion that the federal government has. But, if, you know, back to your multi-party idea, I really think that it would actually produce a wider spectrum and a wider view of the American people. You know, I mean, good grief. I mean, in France, they've just got quite, you know, I don't think enough where you can't even keep track of them. You know, because of that, you know, does it make some stronger in that aspect? It does, you know, but it also gives, you know, it gives those of variant views. And, you know, we do live in a nation of 310 million people. You know, it would give a wider variety of people to suit your personal interest. It would certainly kind of keep the, it would provide it in and of itself a check and balance to our government because, well, just imagine if the Tea Party were their own party, just for example, and they weren't running along with the Republicans, and they had their own politicians, and they're not beholden to the Republican Party. You know, I mean, I think it would create a dynamic change in this country that's, well, really, it's quite long overdue.
Mm-hmm. So there are other parties out there, such as the Libertarian Party, the Constitution Party, the Green Party. You know, so there definitely are. Just the duopoly that exists is just so powerful, it really pushes out the other, you know, grassroots parties.
Well,
you
it does.
I
was just, you know, just in regards to some of the other parties, you know, like the Constitution Party, for example, this is something I've just recently learned about, so they're obviously not getting much press. And, you know, the Libertarian Party, and they've been around for quite some time, but the problem with the Libertarian Party, and I'm not saying this is necessarily occurring currently, okay, it's a history, it's a problem of history, and they have really nominated some very strange people for president in the past.
Who's that?
And
the Libertarian
Party. Yeah, they have nominated some quite odd birds in the past, and I believe it's, you know, it's tainted what people believe in. I mean, I guess Gary Johnson was running with them last time, and he seemed fairly normal, but then you think of, you know, I can't even think of any names. I just remember back in high school and things like that, you know, because I followed politics and whatnot even back then. And, you know, you develop a reputation. And honestly, you have to wonder if they shouldn't, break up their party and make a new one because they're not the same party as they were before.
Hmm. Well, I wouldn't know because I didn't even know about the Libertarian Party until, you know, maybe 3 years ago, 4 years ago. I don't know who they had.
Well, I've known about them for a while. Cause, I mean, I have been following, you know, national politics, and I must say that I do follow national politics more than local. Maybe, much to later on my regret, but I mean, I always, you know, have been more, let's be honest, enamored by national politics and local. But I do think that, you know, local politics, such as city and state, you know, politics is going to be even more important in the years to come as a buffer against the federal government. Now, as you know, Dr. White pointed out, it's going to be very difficult because you know the Commerce Clause, and maybe we should definitely do something about it. It's of course going to be kind of hard, even you know, with the composition of the Supreme Court. And one of the things that actually I believe that Virgil Good from the Constitution Party brought up about the Supreme Court is actually instead of them having a lifetime appointment, maybe they should be elected and perhaps have term limits for them as well.
Well, or perhaps do something that I believe has only been done one time in the history of the entire United States, and that would be to impeach Supreme Court justices, which can be done.
Right, and I think Newt Gingrich brought that up. I believe Newt Gingrich talked about impeaching
yep.
judges.
Yep.
And you know, and that's I didn't even know, honestly, I didn't even know that was possible until just this, until after I became, you know, until after I started Overpasses, got to do reading up more on impeachment. And I was like, seriously, you could impeach a Supreme Court? I mean, I just thought you were stuck with them. And I would guarantee you that I'm not the only guy out there that thought that we were just stuck with them no matter what.
I did. I thought
yeah,
that, sure.
I thought they were like Elliot Ness. They're untouchable. You're never going to get rid of them, you know. And so that was it. The one thing I guess I suppose that would be an interesting thing to look at would be to see, well, exactly what it would take to impeach them. Because if you really wanted to change the face of a lot of things in America, well, that's less than a dozen that. You know, people you could change and have a dramatic change in what laws were constitutional, what laws were not.
But don't you have to impeach through the Congress?
Well, but, you know, so does the president, and so does another congressman.
Right. Well, I'm just saying our Congress is so wimpy and lily-livered right now. Our leadership is so liberal that I don't think you could ever impeach anybody right now. I mean, that's why we can't impeach Obama.
I'm not sure if even liberal is the word for them right now, although there certainly is a huge amount of spineless would be a word I would use for the majority of Congress. Socialists, they have an agenda for
mm-hmm.
control, you know, for control. And that's why we've got to, well, it's really we've got to get out and vote, and we'll find out if it's rigged or not. I think when 2014 rolls around, I think America is either going to be in for a great big wake up call, or they're going to realize there's still hope for this union. Let's hope there's still hope. Hope for hope. That's kind of sad, isn't it, that we're hoping for hope?
Hope for hope.
Yeah.
It's kind of sad. We've reached such a stage.
Yeah.
We're hoping,
right.
We've reached such a sad state in America that we're hoping for hope. I don't even know what to say about that.
Well you know why that's scary.
Real quick, Cindy, I apologize, but you know, mentioning hope, I want to use that as a kind of a segue, a little opener for people going to the Bard's Logic Political Talk website and going to the Give page, and you can help give some hope there as well by checking out my two most recent folks I've had on there, and that is to the Angel Heart Farm, which is a nonprofit organization that uses equine assisted therapy for children and their families facing chronic or life-threatening illness. It's a beautiful farm that has been around for about 12 years and has served children and their families in a caring environment where children can experience the warmth and peace of bonding with the horse and pony, and of course the families get to go there for free, and they can go there anytime they like, and I do have a link to their page where people can donate. And there's also to their website. They can go to the Bard's Logic Little Talk website and go to the Get Involved page, where you can find the link to the Angel Heart Farm, in which you can also find items that they are really in need of as well. And then also recently we've had on Cancer Free Kids, who are also on the Give page. And right now they have, because September is National Childhood Cancer Awareness Month, and for only $10, you can give a stuffed lion to a child newly diagnosed with cancer. And one way to do that is by just going into your cell phones and putting in for the number 80-100, and then in the body of the text, type in lion, L-I-O-N, and just follow the prompts, and just for $10. And there may be some data feeds associated with it, and follow the prompts, and you can send a little stuffed animal lion called Courage the Lion to some children. Also, you can, lastly, and we'll move on, is you can email me at bardslogic@gmail.com. To find ways where you can send magazine subscriptions to military organizations, but that only lasts until September 25th for that program. So folks can contact me through the contact page on the website or through the Bard's Logic email, once again, at bardslogic@gmail.com. So we'll move on. Thank you very much for humoring me to get those little promotions out. So go ahead. I think we who did I interrupt? Was that you, Cindy? I'm sorry.
Yep, Cindy was next.
Okay, good, Cindy. I apologize for the interruption. I just want to get those out while we're still towards the bottom half of the hour. We have 20 minutes of live time. We may not go into extended version. We'll see how things go. So go ahead, Cindy. As she's hammering something in.
Oh,
the room
that's my
dog. No,
that's you, James. that was James.
She's probably coming and wagging like crazy. So I apologize.
I was totally muted and I was talking away. Nobody heard me.
Oh no.
No, it's okay. I was going to go back to the comment that James made a little while ago that. You know, Hillary saying that, you know, what difference does it make? I was just thinking, you know, the way Obama got elected, and not only the way he got elected because no one knew him, but also the way he got reelected after the trauma that he put our nation through and all the jobless people and everything,
mm-hmm.
still got elected again. And I'm thinking, man, you mean to tell me Hillary can win? Sure she can, because those people
certainly
will elect whoever they want to elect, and it doesn't matter what she said. She can get elected. But, I'm thinking this is going to be great because whoever's running against her, this should be their speech. Well, our nation's another $4 trillion in debt because of Obama's policies, but what difference does it make? People losing jobs from the health care crisis. Nobody's, you know, keeping their jobs. They don't want to pay the health care.
Mm-hmm.
What difference does it make? The IRS is abusing conservatives. Ah, what difference does it make? Benghazi, we lost 4 good men in Benghazi. Well, what difference does it make? I mean, you can just go down the list. I mean, that'd be a great campaign speech, don't you think?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I would also.
Speaking of Benghazi, could you give us an update, James, on how your vigil went last week?
Oh, it actually went
yeah.
very, very well. We had one of the widows, and terrible with names, that of the Extortion 17 mission that attended, and that was quite. I was honored to have her present, for our vigil. We actually set up candles. We did it at Stars and Stripes Park in Oklahoma City, and we had 34 candles, and we had 30 of them at the perimeter around the flag, one for each member of Extortion 17 that was killed, and then we had 4 in the cardinal directions, north, south, east, and west, for the 4 people lost in Benghazi. We also had someone there that was filming the entire thing, and she's going to be putting it together into a mini documentary, I guess is what you would call it. And I think it went very, very well. I mean, it was a very emotional type night. I feel like that everybody there, and it was going on all across the country. And I'm talking about what we were doing, but there were actually, there were chapters all across the country with overpasses that were doing the exact same thing at the same time. And, you know, it was really, I'm glad that we were able to finally give those guys some honor, you know, and the respect that our president just simply has refused to do so. And I hope we brought some closure for that, because his daughter was there too. You know, it was the widow and the daughter of one of the lost in the Extortion 17 mission that we can thank Joe Biden former Justice Secretary Panetta for dooming. You know, and I hope it helped. I really do. I hope that there were other members that, you know, across the country, or, you know, relatives there across the country that had, you know, at least heard about them, because, you know, that was the thing, was to bring some closure for them, and to let them know that the people of America do care, and it does matter. It does make a difference. And we haven't forgotten them, and we won't forget them until there's answers given, until somebody pays for what happened there, because, quite honestly, lives were lost, and it was because of depraved indifference. They simply did not care whether those people lived or died, and in both situations. And somebody has got to pay for that, and we won't forget. And so, I mean, I hope that they understand that we haven't forgotten them, and we aren't the only ones. There's millions of people around this country that know exactly, you know as good as what can be known about what happened there. We all know one thing. It was wrong. It should have never happened. Neither of those incidents should have ever happened. And somebody will eventually be brought to justice for it. I don't know if it'll be this year or next year. You know, maybe it'll take 20 years, but it's not going to stop. They're not going to be forgotten. And we'll make sure that something happens, you know, to bring some justice to that situation.
Well, we did that in here in our county. We had a vigil on the main street crossroads in the land where we held our signs that said, you know, don't forget Benghazi. And we tried to get the word out. You wouldn't believe the people that went by. We didn't even ask for a honk. Our signs didn't say to honk or anything. But as we just quietly stood there with our signs, and they were just honking and thumbs up and everything. Nobody gave us a bird or anything. Who would dare?
Yeah, that's always good to hear. You know, party lines don't matter when it comes to somebody dying. And
yeah.
I'm glad to hear that, you know, that was the case there. I really am. It's that's good to hear. I hadn't heard that yet. So, we do. Americans all do have a common point, and that is, you know, we don't leave people to die, and we make sure that there's some justice done. And it's not being done yet, but it will. And I'm glad that everybody that came along agreed with you on that respect by showing your appreciation.
Yeah, they did. I was proud of them. If they just didn't know anything about it, they just kind of drove on by, and you know, they don't make any kind of a response at all. But at least, you know, every time the light changed, somebody that went by honked. So it was nice to see that, and it did my heart good. Know that at least there's some people out there that do care. I don't like being the only one, you know, and none of us like to be the only one that feels the way we do, and it's just nice to know that other people are with you and have the same beliefs.
And I just wanted to let the folks know that for those of you who have liked the Bard's Logic Political Talk page there on Facebook, if you haven't already, go there and please do. It's always nice to see people like the page, and also they can join the group, the Bard's Logic Political Talk group there on Facebook, where now I do have the link to Amy Murray's campaign webpage up. So just go to the page and check it out. I have the link there, and I also shortly will also have the link on the Bard's Logic Political Talk website. Go ahead, guys. Thank you.
Oh, well, I'd actually like to make a request, possibly, you know, for a song sometime. If you ever have the opportunity to play another one, and I love the music you play. I had never heard that before. I thought I was like, listen, I thought I was like in the Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Or something.
Yeah.
Well, actually, the music does come, a lot of it does come from a video game I like to play. And that's called Dragon Age. So that's where a lot of music comes from.
Okay.
And Aubrey Ashburn, who
have
I have
played video games.
Get back in the archives. Go ahead, Cindy.
Do you have time to play video games?
Well, I usually play video games on Friday or Saturday night from about 1 o'clock to in the morning till 5:30 in the morning. So that's the only time I get to do that. So it's once
a
week.
That's a weird schedule right there.
Entertainment. I wonder what that would be like. I haven't done that in a while.
Oh, it's, you know, well, I have a cup of coffee normally around midnight, and then I have another cup of coffee about 2:30. And then I just, you know, play until it's, I guess I, like, well, I can't play no more, so I'm going to go to sleep. So that's generally the only time. But that's where a lot of music comes on. But what song request did you have? I don't know if I have it on.
It's by an artist named Jeremy Dodge, and he's actually given us the rights to use his songs for the Overpass movement. And our theme song is called I Am American. Now, the beauty about that song is it straight up says it's not about party, it's about what's right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that, you know, and that's one of the, that really was from the very beginning before he had ever, you know, he had ever heard the movement and gave us permission to use the song. That was one of the themes we've really trumped on and just emphasized on, is the whole thing is it isn't about party, it's about what's right. And it's pretty simple when you think about it like that. And you know, if you ever get the opportunity to play that on air and let people listen to it, I mean, it kind of makes you want to go, you know, throw open your front door and scream out into the night, I am American. It's a, you know.
Well, I tell you
what,
if you could, James, or I can look it up myself, send me a link, and what I can do is I can get an audio file. And I can put it in the audio file, and I can open up next week's, which is September 25th, show with that song. And next week I'm looking to have the show we want to discuss, and we're going to try to get some more folks on, including you two, if you can make it. And then, of course, our other panel is Kelly Mordecai. And I do have another guest. I'm not going to say who I'm working on getting on the show. It's kind of a long stretch of the arm, but we'll see, because I've only given the person's a week notice, and this is somebody who may need more time than that just because of his busy schedule. But I won't say who I've whose people I contacted yet, but because if I do get a chance to get them on the show, I think it'll be a nice surprise. It's not Newt Gingrich, which I'd love to have Newt Gingrich on the show,
I wish it was.
But it does have to do with the topic that we're going to have next week, and that's going to be about defunding Obamacare.
Yeah. So, well, I'm just going to shoot for Alan West, because I'd like to thank him for giving us props in D.C. on 9/11.
Well, there you go. Well, then we'll see. That definitely gets put some more into mind on it. So.
Hey, James. Will you say that artist's name again, the I Am America, that was by Jeremy what?
Jeremy Dodge, like Dodge Trucks.
Ah, yeah, Dodge
City. I Am American.
Okay.
He also does another one called Stand Up, and he does an awesome cover of God Bless the USA, and he's got about four songs is all he's got. And they are actually available on iTunes, and so if you want to go buy that, normally wouldn't give anybody an endorsement like that, but he has been wonderful, you know, in giving us the rights to use just some incredible songs. And so hey, if you like it, buy it.
Well, go ahead, Cindy.
I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say I'm going to take over temporarily the administration of our local Overpasses Rally Facebook page, and I may plan a couple of overpass rallies in the next week or two, and I think it'd be cool if we could get this and play it, you know, on a boombox out there while we're out there, just to kind of get people, you know, motivated.
Absolutely. You know, and you know, that's one thing that I'd like to, you know, anybody that's listening, if you've never gone out and protested, this isn't like Occupy where we're destroying public property. If you come to one of ours, you will have a great time. You will leave so stress relieved. You will even you'll be tired. You'll be sweaty, and you'll be happy you were there.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
Well, I'd like at some point soon I'd like to get to one of the rallies so I can I'd definitely like to get some audio from that so I can incorporate into one of the shows. One of the subsequent shows, but you know, next week, you know, it's going to be because there's a vote coming up on Obamacare that's coming up, I believe, October 1st, or you know, the budget where he's in there. So I really want to make that push, you know,
well,
for folks to get a hold of their congressmen and congresswomen and things of that nature.
You'd be glad to know that on September 28th, which is only 3 days before that, we will actually be having a national event. Where that will be one of the main speaking points that we're using with signs is, you know, defund Obamacare or, you know, abolish Obamacare would be better. Getting rid of the money is fine, but it still leaves the law in place. I'm not sure exactly how the defunding works. Obviously, it would stop its implementation for X amount of time, but I would just rather just see it go to the recycle bin and be turned into, I don't know, an overpasses sign. That'd be awesome. 2,000 pages of law and 20,000 pages of regulations to go along with the law. Yeah, that'd make some fantastic overpasses signs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, make some signage out of it.
Yeah.
Well, I do see that it is only 4 minutes left of live time. So if there is anyone in the chat who would like to call in and listen to the extended period, we'll probably go in there for at least a few minutes. You can call into the show at area code 347-945-7428, and you can listen to the extended version, or if you'd like to chime in after calling in, just press the 1 on your number dial. And I'll let you in, and all mics do stay open. I don't know how long we'll go into the extended period, but for the folks who are listening in and want to get that, please feel free to do so. But if not, the show will be open for the archives to listen immediately following the show. And, of course, share the link, whether you email it to someone or share the link on Facebook or Twitter. Or you can also download these shows and put it on a CD so you can share with other people to listen to. And also, Bard's Logic is also on iTunes, the episodes you can find on iTunes. But you don't have to buy these. They are free to download from iTunes. So that's something to consider telling folks about as well. So we've got about 3 minutes of the live time before we go into the extended version. So we'll get back to the discussion here about defunding Obamacare and the overpasses. So whichever one of you I've butted into, go ahead.
I don't think anybody was talking. You came in right at the right time.
Oh, well, good. I don't always do that. And I don't know if we'll have Bard's Logic after dark like we did the other day. That was, no. I remember that. And for folks who want to hear the Bard's Logic after dark, just check out the episode last week that we had. And there was just some funny stuff going on after the midnight part of the show, after the first two live hours of the show.
Yeah, we got the going, didn't we? Hey, there's somebody named Thundercracker. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just I was thinking of something that would make an entertaining show at the very least, and that would be if you were could locate, basically make it into almost like a debate forum. Bring somebody in here that's a ardent Obama supporter, and have them try to explain themselves.
Oh yeah, definitely. And we've had Cindy knows because she's been here since the beginning. We've had during the elections, we definitely had some folks come in We had some debate, maybe not too much Democrat and Republican debate, but we did have some debate about the different candidates. Remember, Cindy? And
well, yes,
we do
because,
have...
you know, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, we do have someone who's called in and want to chime in, so I'm going to open up their mic, and then we will bring it back to you, Cindy. So the area code's 530. Thank you very much for calling to the show. How are you? 530, your mic is live.
Oh, hey, this is Kelly here.
Oh, hey, Kelly. Okay, I thought I seen the 530 and... the rest of the number, I guess, the lack of dinner tonight is affecting that. So thank you very much. I'm glad you called in.
Oh, yeah, I'm just more listening now. I just had, I think, hit one before you guys go into overtime, so I'm still in there.
Okay, great. Great.
So I just
got to
be quiet for a while and catch up.
Did you catch the earlier part of the show?
You mean Michelle Obama?
No, not Michelle Obama.
Well,
I said... catch any of the show. The earlier part of the show with we had Amy Murray on, and we also had Professor Timothy White on. I didn't know if you were able to catch listen into those parts of the show.
No, I took my son to like Awana's, and I just tucked him in bed. But yeah, I did it with Michelle Obama, and I don't know why, but I've had a series of Michelles in my life that didn't work out, and it's just another one. I think six or seven Michelles. I don't know. It's like the name has occurred to me. I can't explain it, you know. There was this Michelle from high school, other Michelle, college. Oh, and then when I was in eighth grade, that Michelle. It don't work for me. I don't know what the deal is. That's why I didn't vote for Obama, by the way, because his wife's name was Michelle.
Yeah, I'm sure that had a lot to do with it.
That's my wife's name.
Whoops.
You're kidding, right?
No, I'm serious. My wife's name's Michelle.
No. Oh,
and I have a sister, Michelle. Yes.
Well, there is Michelle Bachmann to counter the communism of Michelle Obama. So, you know,
yeah,
it's not they can't all.
Yeah, I like her in her, in the position that she's in politically. I didn't really like her as a candidate, to be honest, but.
Yeah,
but beyond that,
some interesting things, you know. But hey, I think I would rather have had her than the current squatter in chief.
Well,
that's true.
You know, I mean,
anybody.
Well, I wouldn't say anybody. I mean, Romney. I mean, well, not only.
Well,
I think if Romney was elected, the conservatives, you know, a lot of conservatives would have thought, well, okay, well, we've got Republican there, and now it's time to relax. And I think.
Yeah.
That would not have been good.
Yeah,
I think you may have a point there, actually, because that's the last thing that needs to happen. You know, I really think as far as the direction this country is going, we have got to take an extraordinarily hard turn to the right just to get back to the center.
Yeah.
No, I agree. I do agree with that, and
but we're interrupting the other caller, so we ought to let him say something. He's been sitting here waiting to say something, so.
Go ahead, Kelly.
Oh, I'm still trying to catch up, but I'm just calling in. That's all. I put my son to bed. I'm like, oh, hey, I wonder how the people are doing at Bart's Logic. So I guess I'll just listen for a while.
Well, you know, we've been talking about the importance of local elections tonight.
Right. Yeah, we had a candidate on from city council who she's got a big battle on her hands because the city council that she's fighting to get on comprised of seven Democrats, one independent, and one Republican. And I think it's really important for her to get on, especially because, I mean, and she talked about that voter block. I wish we would have been able to spend more time talk about the block aspect with Dr. White, but, you know, perhaps on later shows, where I think that even – that's why I think, you know, folks who are not even from Cincinnati or even Ohio should pay attention and perhaps even, send some funds her way to help out with her campaign because, you know, she's got such a hard fight here in Cincinnati. And, you know, I think it's important to have and your candidates who, you know, who are conservatives and strong conservatives like she is, and move them up, you know, the ranks after, you know, city council, because then after that, you know, it's county and state and forward. And so I think it's important for her to really get in, and also so that, you know, we don't have almost like a domino effect where first we had Detroit, and let me tell you, Cincinnati, Ohio is seriously on the verge of becoming another Detroit, you know, 10 years from now.
Oh. Wow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Cincinnati could definitely be Detroit in another 10 years.
Well, I guess they could tax the football players more since they make so much money, right?
Well, yeah, with that, we shouldn't have to be paying for a stadium, not the team now. Yeah, but, you know, if, you know, you've got the, you know, she pointed out, you know, you have the Democrats who are just kicking issues down the can, just continuously spending money we don't have. There's pension, you know, the public sector pension is getting out of hand, you know, so, and that's happening, you know, as I mentioned earlier, across the country. And, of course, that's, you know, one of the things I believe Detroit was dealing with as well, you know. So, you know, Cincinnati could very well fall into that, especially if they keep up with, electing these liberal politicians.
Well, I got a question for Kelly and James and you too, Robert. You know, as I've told you, our county finally elected two more Republicans to put them on our county council. We have seven seats. Now we have three. Well, this issue about a 10% tax increase in our property taxes has come up. And for the last few weeks, we've been struggling against two of the very Republicans that we just put in there thinking that we're going to, you know, speak for us. And now we find that they may not be for us. In fact, a Democrat, one of the Democrats that's on the council, has voted against the tax increase. And then one of those Republicans that we voted in, the other two Republicans have not come down on our side so far. Now, we're still in the process of working things out. We don't necessarily have to have the 10% increase yet, but out of two votes that we've had already on it for continuing, you know, to go on down the road with it, those two Republicans kept voting for it. Now, what do we do, guys, to keep, what is our strategy to keep them in our camp? They're jumping ship.
Well, to Kelly here, there's two answers to your question. One you may not want to hear. You know, I do civil engineering, and counties actually do have a lot of expenses. And the good news about county taxes, they are pretty dang efficient compared to state and federal. There might be a need for more law enforcement, for example. Of course, you always get the library controversy. Oh, we're out of money to close the library. Really? Anyway, so inflation is another problem. There's reasons on the civil side why they appear to be turncoats when, oh, yeah, I'm not going to raise taxes. Hey, no, I'm against taxes. They get in there, look at the books, and they're like, oh, my gosh, we don't want to be like Orange County. They went bankrupt. They're Stockton. Of course, the unions are a big problem with Stockton, California. But that might explain why they're turncoats or have the appearance of turncoats when they see the whole needs. On the other hand, another way to combat this, have you heard of the, it's called CAFR, C-A-F-R, Comprehensive Annual Financial Report?
No.
This is a spooky one. We got to get Keith Broders on your show, Robert. He has researched this. Other people, there's an accountant that discovered it. Basically, I mean, I heard this before and I thought this was bunk, but he started explaining it to me and I started looking at the PDF file of CAFRs. CAFRs are the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report. And what is discovered is that cities take money and they invest it in bonds, they invest it in stock markets, they invest it, invest it, invest it. And meanwhile, they're saying, oh, we don't have enough money, we don't have enough money. He was citing one city, I think it was L.A., that had like billions stashed away. And not only can they run the city just on those hidden assets, another one is land, which at times they have to hold on to, but, you know, here in the city of Yreka, we are conservative bill as can be. At a county fair, I saw a Democrat behind a booth, and I said to somebody, look, there is actually one Democrat, it's just Hugh County. And they just busted up laughing. But they have it, too, and they've got a whole bunch of land. They're the largest landowner of the city of Yreka in Yreka. It's unbelievable. So you're screaming about money and wants to sell some of your lots. I mean, this is ridiculous. You can always buy more later if you need to. So they have all these assets. If you can research the CAFR, Google that on YouTube or just Google CAFR, and it's a long, lengthy report, and there's guides on how to find the final table. This is required by federal law that they have these reports. Find it, find the numbers, and then go to this guy and say, look, do you know? A lot of these guys don't even know until they get in there for several years that they have these assets. It's point-blank spooky. Not only would L.A. run by itself for years, they should be giving a tax rebate to everybody.
Ooh.
Yeah, so look up CAFR. Yeah, so go look it up and go to your Republican and say, hey, here's all these assets. Give us a break here, guys.
Well, one thing you could say about land is that somebody will almost assuredly buy it because there's only so many square miles of it on the planet Earth. In fact, I believe the five richest people in America own just millions of acres because it's a finite resource. And, you know, it will only go up as the population goes up. Well, there will be occasional bumps, you know, because of the economy. But they'd be hard-pressed to say the land was worth less than what it was when they bought it.
Yeah. You know? Well, they've held on to some of this land for literally decades. You know, I mean,
idea. That's an excellent suggestion. I mean, first off, I'd never heard of that. I think the only time I'd heard the term CAFR had something to do with Islam, and it wasn't a good thing. It was like basically a double agent of some sort. I'm not sure if it's the right word, but that's the only thing that comes to mind when you say that.
Well, yeah, here's an analogy, basically. Imagine an employee that's, you know, he's way up there in management, makes $120,000 a year, and he's got $1 million in assets. And he goes to his boss and said, oh, I need a raise from $120,000 to $140,000 a year. Really? That's similar to what several of these government entities are doing.
Yeah. Well, the fact we give, like, the IRS, they get bonuses for collecting taxes. You know, I would just think how keeping your job would be what you should get for collecting taxes, not getting a bonus for collecting extra taxes. But, hey, that's a different story.
Yeah. Well, I could tell horror stories about that one, too, but I won't go there tonight. But, Keith Broder's on your show, Robert.
Yep. And what is that spell? I actually just relocated back to the front of my computer because you go. What is that called again? The long version.
Well, CAFR, Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, and it's kind of coded. It's a long, lengthy report, but hidden in all these pages is essentially the assets and what they have invested in bonds and other stuff. You can look up for your city. At this point, Mike's spooky. I found one. I'm like, oh, my God, are you serious? And just PDF. I'm like, oh, my gosh, here it is. And there's go to Keith Broder's on Facebook. He's with the Constitutional Club. That's a website, too. You can sign up there. And he's got a radio program, too, and he'll tell you about CAFR. But, or if you know, it's just spooky. And
okay.
These new guys probably don't have a clue about it.
Go ahead, Cindy.
Keith Broadhurst.
Broaders, B-R-O-A-D-E-R-S.
Oh, okay.
or just Constitution Club?
And that was C-A-F-R.
Yeah, Comprehensive Annual Financial Report.
Didn't find much looking to find the one for 2012 of Norman, Oklahoma, anyway, which isn't, it's the second closest town to me.
Yeah, look it up in L.A. Yeah, look up L.A. Should be online PDF.
Okay.
But, yeah, there's, Keith probably, well, in Constitution Club, he should have something about it, but, and there's a way to decode it, or at least quickly go to page 191, something like that. And these new guys, when I say new, I mean these newly elected people, they have no clue about it.
Well, you know, we have, you know, the first thing that you mentioned about that county governments have a lot of, you know, expenses and all that, and they got to come up with, and yes, the books are looking bad, and that's all true. But the problem is we're spending a whole lot of money on stuff that's not necessary, things like parks. Our county has bought 30% of our county's land. It's all to do with Agenda 21 stuff. And because of that, we have 30% of our county that is not taxable property now. So what? The rest of us.
Oh, jeez.
The rest of us have to pay the rest of the price. So, you know, when you're buying parks, they're getting ready to build a brand new public works building. Well, you do that when the building that you're in is just completely ramshackle and you just can't stay in it any longer. You don't just build it because, well, I don't like this location and I want to expand a little bit. We just do not need another building. We don't need any more parks. Bike paths. We don't need to buy any more land, and we've offered to them suggestions of how they could save money. We drive these huge big buses around, these VOTRAN buses for our city buses, and there's three people in them. Now, why don't we have a van that's like half the size of the huge bus that we're running around? Okay, and why don't we get our county employees to give in a percentage of their retirement. I mean, it's ridiculous with the retirement money that we have to come up with. There's just tons of things that we can do and we can stop spending, and yet they don't want to do that. They want to keep spending and spending and spending. We're even adding a new fire fee in order to keep our fire department going. We've got another fire fee. Used to be our fire department was run city by city. Now the county has it all under one umbrella. Now we have the complete bill for that.
Yeah, we have volunteer fire department in Wairika. We've got a volunteer one in Fort Jones. Up in Hornbrook, there's another volunteer one. Aetna's got one. We had I don't know. It just stuck since, you know, decades or even 1800s. People volunteered. Obviously, that's saving a lot of money, except for fire trucks.
No doubt we've gotten technically advanced in firefighting, and there's a lot of schooling involved now. You know, you've got to be on the ball to be in the firefighting realm now, but still firefighters and we've also got a firefighter showing up at every single accident where the ambulance is called. A fire truck is also required to show up. Now you tell me why that is.
Because they're trained for emergency stuff, supposedly. I mean,
well, then you do.
Well, they're basically a firefighter is a combo paramedic as well. I mean, they, you know, because
right.
I mean, very often they do come across a situation, and particularly like where I live here, the closest ambulance is 35 minutes away. The volunteer fire department is 10 at most, and that's
right.
including calling their volunteers in the area to, you know, show, you know, get the call, show up to the volunteer fire department, get their gear on, and get to my house is 10 minutes. Whereas, you know, like I said, the closest ambulance is 35 minutes out. And so, you know, I mean, that would explain, you know, some of their extra training that they would have to go to go there. I've actually known several of them, and they see some things none of us would ever want to see.
Oh, I know.
And, you know, but that's the amazing thing. They actually saved the property I live on, the house I live on, and really it just seems like volunteer fire departments would be a one way to, unless it's just an absolute area, you know, like, well, Los Angeles, we all know it can set on fire at any time. It's happened enough times. But you know, they obviously need a full-time paid fire department. But for any time when a
ambulance can show up before the fire department, I mean, that should happen. There's no excuse for both being dispatched at the same time when we know good and well one is closer than the other, and you know that can be the ambulance, and so there ought to be some kind of a formula for that we don't have to spend double the money for both paramedic units to show up at the accident or just somebody's somebody's heart attack at the Publix or you know whatever.
Well, here's another thing you might want to watch out for, which is an advantage, by the way, if they do raise taxes. You know, forget I told you anything about CAFR for this discussion. Which would you rather have? Federal grants with heavy strings? You will do this, you will do that. Years ago, for a certain period, Siskiyou County would receive, the sheriff would get a grant, but the federal government had enormous say-so over the sheriff. Or would you rather have more taxes and put the middle finger to the federal government because of these heavy string grants? One of the sheriffs, when he ran, is Rick Riggins, neat guy and all, one of the local patriots, Terry. He'd known him for all his life, pretty much. Terry told me, yeah, I walked up to Riggins one day, we're talking, and I says, you know what, you sign any of these heavy string grants, I will personally cut your nuts off.
Well.
Hey, okay.
I'm still listening.
Well, I'm not sure I would want to go there, but I would like to put a little pressure on my councilman.
Well, I'll tell you what, though, as far as those pressure federal grants and whatnot like that, that's a big part of what's going on that's wrong in this country. I mean, up until, you know, the last really 100 years, it really started in 1871 when, you know, the federal government became a corporation. But, I mean, it just got increasingly worse. At one point, and for a long period of time in this nation, the federal government had to beg the states for money. And we've gone backwards. And I really, it would be an interesting thing to see just how well the federal government would serve the people of the United States if they had no federal tax, where it was all, they were basically beholden to the states to get any money at all to operate. I would think that if we could somehow spin the clock back to an era like that, we would see, well, obviously we'd have a much smaller federal government, which would then have the desired side effect of a whole lot less federal interference. I mean, it's one thing if your state's telling you what to do. You could move to another state. You can't move to another America.
Yeah.
Right. Well,
I remember my mother talking about World War II and how there was gas rationing and this rationing, and you only have a pair of shoes or, you know, every so often. It was probably harder on women than it was men, but, you know, certain rations
for
shoes. Now. Yeah. And, you know, people were buying bonds. And in the Saturday matinee, they'd have a buy bond commercial. You know, it's like the government was not just asking the states for more money. They were asking for Americans to buy bonds. now they just print the money out of thin air. And, you know, Alex Jones was talking today, which what he talked about was real interesting when he interviewed Congressman Walter Jones. But he was talking about the war in Iraq and Afghanistan is like $1.2 trillion or something, $12 million an hour to fund these wars. The war in Syria, of course, 90% of the people are against it. They did a private, or there's a military poll. Somebody's got a military poll. Only servicemen can, and women can vote on this. 75% were against it. And Congressman Jones from North Carolina was expressing that he's on the Joint House Arms Committee, and he says that he's working on articles of impeachment for Obama in the event that he does go to war without congressional approval. And Democrats are working on the same thing, too. But Bonner is no, we're not going to do that. And Bonner is blocking investigation for Benghazi. I mean, how did Bonner, what is up with Bonner? So there was some really interesting news going on.
I think I actually know what's going on with him. I thought it was actually pronounced Boehner, but either way, whatever. It's kind of like the NFL.
I've
heard
other,
guys,
I have heard other pronunciations.
Yeah, but honestly, you want to know what I think is going on with Boehner or Bonner or whatever his name is?
Boehner.
Well, we all know, Boehner, that's my favorite one. I think really what's going on with him is we all know he's a drunk. I think he had a large indiscretion during an intoxicated period, and it's being used to blackmail him because somebody has proof on it.
I totally agree with you. It's a Kennedy-type situation. I believe you. I wouldn't doubt that one iota.
I've heard three sources independent about the hire of the prostitutes, actually a fourth if you count Michael Rupert. One guy is a personal friend of mine. He had high security clearance, and he was like the aide to a general. He's a really neat guy, and he was telling me that he was there at some big shindig, and a buddy told him that hey, they brought prostitutes in here for these congressmen.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard this from three or four different sources now. It's point blank spooky to find a way to blackmail these jokers.
Well, I mean, they're not exactly the most moral fellows in the world and ladies in the world. I mean, when they pass a law that allows them to do insider Wall Street trading, when that's like illegal for anybody else on the planet to do. Well, obviously we've got an integrity issue going on, and I mean, anybody that signed that law and anybody in the Senate that signed that amnesty bill should be in prison.
Yeah,
you know, the amnesty bill was you know, it's direct treason. I mean, we're being invaded, granted, albeit a largely peaceful invasion, but nevertheless, the security of the United States is being destroyed, you know, by an invasion from south of the border, but yet they want to sign an amnesty bill that will bring in 20 million more than already exists. That seems
right
to me it's a direct violation of their oath. There seems like there needs to be some sort of stronger or procedure in place or an amendment of some sort. I don't know if an amendment would be appropriate, but a very strong federal law that if you violate your oath of office, you can be immediately relieved. And you can appeal it, of course, just like any other, you know, criminal finding. But they need to be held accountable, again, and their feet kept to the fire so that they will remain honest. And I'm not sure exactly what it would take to do that, but there's got to be something.
Well, our congressman here, Rick Santorum, Ron DeSantis has proposed a new 28th Amendment that simply says that the Congress can make no law that doesn't also pertain to themselves. I think that would go a long way in stopping some of the stuff that's going on up there in Washington.
Well, I think so, too. And, you know, the funny thing is I've lived under the – that's another political fantasy that I've heard, that I've lived under my entire life is I thought that was already the case.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. There you go.
You know, and come to find out that, you know, as corrupt as our Congress may have been in the past, they kept each other from doing that, and that's not the case now.
Yep.
Well, what it is really is, well, let me ask you this question. Do you like lettuce?
Sure.
Well, yeah, sure.
Going back to illegals, see, the reason why you have cheap lettuce is because of all these illegal immigrants picking it for you.
No, I have cheap lettuce because I'm growing it.
Well, I'm so laughing at myself because that's the
yeah, it's Brian Feinstein's logic behind it.
Yeah, but on the other hand, it could be some of the most expensive lettuce the world has ever seen when the full consequences hit home.
Mm-hmm.
Well, sure, when the economy collapses and the lettuce might as well cost $1 million a head, then yeah, mm-hmm.
When you're given $50,000 a year to a single family of migrant workers for health care and food stamps and whatever other welfare they're allowed to get, that's a real expensive head of lettuce.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just sickening. And I don't think that if you're not a citizen of the United States, you shouldn't receive a penny in any assistance. I'm sorry, if you're hungry. You came from another place where you could go back to if it's really that bad here.
Right. Yeah. If it's definitely.
Well,
let me tell you why Mexicans want to be here. My daughter-in-law is Mexican, and right now in the state of Guerrero, they are getting hit by two hurricanes, one after the other. The one hurricane that went over them 2 days ago has taken out the bridge, the only bridge that they have to get to Altamirano, where they get their food from. They're out in the middle of nowhere in a village, and the river that they drink their water out of, which is filthy in the beginning, is now a raging flooded river that you can't even hardly stand close to because the banks are getting eaten out by the raging rapids that are going by them. And the town of Altamirano is underwater, and I'm talking people, the same kind of stuff that New Orleans had, where people can't get on the roof, and then the roof is underwater.
Oh, my gosh.
There's been old people die and young and kids die, and just, but you never hear any of this on the TV. No, they're not, and the government there, and all the people tell me this, all the Mexicans tell me this, the government there will not go to their rescue until after they're finished helping everybody in the tourist towns, Acapulco and such like that, because that's where all the money is, and they basically cater only to the largesse people that have all the power in the government, and so they will not get help. Their road will not get built, and so we're sitting here wondering, Carmen and I and Ben. We're wondering, well, how in the world are we going to get food to them? Because La Chapa and the other cities around them where they all get their food from Altamirano, when the food is gone from those towns, there's just nothing left. And that river being flooded up, there's no water. They don't have city water going out to those villages. There's not even a well in her village. So this is a dire thing, and this isn't the only place. Her little area of the world is not the only place that is going to be suffering under those two hurricanes, plus the drug cartels. Now, since uh, if you knew me back, you know, last year, my daughter-in-law's family was basically pinned down in their home by a drug cartel. They took over her house, made her mother cook for them, and basically just used their house as a headquarters sort of thing for a while. And they were scared to death, every one of them, because these people were out. Their whole job, their mission, was to go out and kidnap young boys to force them into the cartel army. And her brothers, at least two of them, are a very good age. They're exactly the ones that they're looking for. And so, of course, we prayed and prayed that they would not be allowed to hijack them. Unbelievably and miraculously so, they allowed those two boys to go out and work in the fields with their dad in the cornfields. They convinced them that they had to go out there and work in the fields. And while they were out there, they escaped into the mountains. Well, then the only food source they have for meat is to go in the mountains and hunt. Well, those cartels, after they eventually left there, and by the way, that was miraculous too. They just picked up and left for absolutely no reason. They went up into the mountains and started residing up there. And then they had another cartel come in, and there was a big fighting going on, and nobody could go in the mountains. They haven't been in the mountains for almost a year. They got shot at the last time they tried to go up there because they thought it was quiet again. So now this is, and then right after this flood, apparently the cartels used that weakened condition to restart the war again. So they're hearing AK-47 fire all around them right now. And this is the reason why these people are trying to get to America, because this is going on everywhere. I mean, if it's happening in her little town, you know it's everywhere. So I ask you guys to pray for Carmen's family. They're like on an island surrounded by water, and they have no way to get any kind of food or water.
Well,
so that's why they're here, guys, you know, most of them. And
I'm not trying to sound heartless here, but just for a train of thought, that's crossed my mind several times. If they were to, let's say, take their money that they've got here in the United States, you know, that they've earned here in the United States, and return back to Mexico, obviously, you know, you've got a 9-to-1 exchange ratio in Mexico. I mean, we're talking, they estimate that there's about, not the 11 million that they're saying, that's actually a number from the 80s, that it's closer to 30 million people here in the United States that come from Mexico. Well, the total population of Mexico right now is sitting at approximately 115 million. Well, 30 million people, let me do the math here real quick.
That's a mass exodus.
Well, but if they had 30 million people suddenly show up and like how it was here in the United States, I'm thinking that things would get a little better there real quick.
Well, the problem is that as soon as they arrive back in Mexico, they have no job.
Well,
there's a transition period that would have to go on as soon as the markets start increasing for those 30 million people to start buying products and services and you know, food and all that, then maybe in the long run, that's the best thing for Mexico's economy. But in the meantime, they can't find a job, and they also have to worry about getting kidnapped by the cartel.
Well, I mean, one has to wonder then at that point if we could quit fooling around in the Middle East and intervene in Mexico for the security of the United States.
Now that's a good idea.
Why aren't our troops
on the border?
Well, I think that's what they could do with the homeless and jobless veterans that have returned back from war zones that unfortunately, mm-hmm. because of the horrors they've seen in that war zone, really aren't employable at a normal place because, you know, they've got issues now, you know, and they have difficulty in living among the rest of society because, well, they've got problems. I mean, PTSD or, you know, whatever you want to call it, shell shock is what it was originally called, you know. And I mean, I would think that we'd be doing them a service by, you know, getting them the counseling they need. Or first off, have the VA do their jobs instead of just, you know, forgetting them once they get back. That's just one of the worst tragedies in this nation is the fact that our veterans go off and suffer both physically and psychologically, and then they come back and they're forgotten by the Veterans Administration. But I, yep. here's an idea, you know, and I think the majority of Americans would be behind it, and that would be to pull our troops from anywhere overseas that, one, they're not necessary. I mean, I don't really think that Europe is in danger of being invaded by the Soviet Union anymore, well, since, you know, the Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore. And so us having troops in Europe just seems like, rather unnecessary. And, I mean, we've got 900-plus military bases around the world. There's only, 160-some-odd nations on the entire planet? So we've got 900-some-odd military bases scattered around the world, and we're just spending unbelievable amounts of money on them. It seems to me that a good thing to do would be to pull them back from those bases, put them on the border while we retrain the homeless and jobless veterans to be border agents. Let them serve their
Give
nation
them a job.
Again. They're obviously very good at serving America. Let them do that. You know? Let them do that again. They're obviously very good at it and not afraid to do so. So bring our current military back, put them on the border. In the meantime, you train the homeless and you know, homeless and jobless veterans to replace them.
Mm-hmm. Kelly?
I'm still kind of stunned about hearing about Cindy's daughter-in-law.
That's just crazy. I didn't know that was even going on down there, to be honest. That's just wow.
Well, I had heard
Absolutely
about some of that.
Not
yeah.
in the, it's not in the news. Nothing's being talked about.
So how many people are massacred by the cartel and we don't do anything? Why is Syria so important?
Right, exactly.
Very good question. I bet a lot of, I bet a lot of children are suffering for that too, yeah.
Well, you would think that America would be far better.
Year.
That's just insane. You know, but yet we cry, and don't believe me, I'm not belittling this. We cry about, six people getting killed or seven people getting killed in a naval yard, and I'm not understating that, but, I mean, seven compared to 50,000. That's obviously a stability issue in our next-door neighbor. That's far more important to national security than anything going on overseas. It's amazing.
Let me tell you another thing that my son said is going on in their politics over there. You know, President Calderon came in, said he was going to get rid of the drug cartel, started the big drug war, and that's when all this escalated killing began, and the cartels even started fighting each other and the government, and then the government people that were they got hired by the cartel to go on their side, and it got to be a big mess. And so the last president that they elected him because they expected him to stop the war on these cartels. They decided they'd rather have the cartels operating in there rather than have the wars going on. But the problem is, that's not stopping the wars between cartels. It may be
right.
stopping the war between the government and the cartels. The cartels are still fighting each other. That's the problem.
Well, and they are. And I think the term I heard that they're using for Mexico right now is something they actually used in Panama when Manuel Noriega was there, was a narco republic.
Yeah.
And it's basically, yeah, the nation is being run by the cartels directly and indirectly. Mm-hmm. And we had something try to happen like that here back during that little prohibition era by the mafia. And we ended that, but I don't know. That's a complex issue, but it does seem like we should be more interested in the security this close to our nation, you know, in a nation this close to our nation. I would rather spend money assisting Mexico defeat the drug cartels and actually do it, not just blow money into the wind, but
right.
actually give them physical assets to do so, you know, then I would. I mean, honestly, Assad's not a nice guy, but he doesn't go burn down churches and cut people's heads off.
Right. And I don't think he's the one that used the chemical weapons either, if you want to know the truth.
Well, you know, that's one thing that I like about, the one thing I like about Obama, if you want to find out what the truth is, listen to what he says and then look at what the exact opposite of what he says is, and that'll be the truth.
Yeah.
So he is consistent in that respect. You can find out the truth from Obama. You just have to look at the opposite of what he says.
Opposite of what he says.
Well, you know, if we can send troops in and we can send in SEALs and other undercover army people, and we can find Osama bin Laden, and we can find these other Al-Qaeda leaders, and we can take them out. You think we couldn't take out a few drug cartels? I mean, just think about that. I mean,
yeah.
If we spent the money in Mexico.
I think it boils down to the integrity within our own government. I, for years, have called the DEA the Drug Import-Export Agency. Because, I mean, let's face it, if you can get a sweet job down in a country like Colombia and you're down there in a tropical paradise and all you have to do is keep that local drug cartel happy, why would you, you know, and you're going to get paid under the table, why would you mess that up? You know?
Right. Yeah.
You know, I had a client, the guy was up there with Genius, really sharp guy and all. Well, we started talking about, you know, powers to be and yada yada, Federal Reserve, and he knows what's going on, but he tapped you down in kind of a remote area of the county. He went to jail. He was the low man on the totem pole when somebody in law enforcement wanted to actually put somebody behind bars regarding drug trafficking. And he said that he actually saw military planes come in from South America or Central America, and they were just packed with drugs. And Michael Rupert, he's a whistleblower in the sense he used to work for the L.A. Narcotics Division. He saw some FBI agents wheeling and dealing. And he went to his boss, and his boss says, you know, I sure hope you resign in a couple of weeks because I'd hate to go to your funeral.
Wow.
So he's, you know, there's these stories. And so you begin to wonder, is there a lot of money in it for somebody? It's, you know, scratch my back, I'll scratch yours kind of thing, that they really don't do anything about Mexico. And we have the ability that the Mexican president says, hey, U.S., come in here with your military and help us. You know, the will is not there to do it.
So I can actually tell you a couple of places to follow that money to, and we've seen evidence of it here in Oklahoma with sentencing laws, and that would be the private prison corporations. They have no interest in, and they've especially hit all drug crimes. We had a kid here in Oklahoma get 15 years in prison, 15 years for simple possession of marijuana.
Oh,
At 85%.
What?
He had to serve 85% of that sentence.
Wow.
That's ridiculous.
We literally, we have corporate entities in this nation that operate these private prisons, they have absolutely no desire or incentive whatsoever to, they have every incentive to continue the drug trade so they can continue locking people up. And if the governor here in this state had a very large party, I'm sure it was quite an event when you spend $500 million that you didn't have to come up with. Or maybe it was $50 million, but either way, $50 million, $500 million, and it was all funded by private prison companies.
Oh,
I believe it was $50 million. I think I was overstating it. But either way, $50 million, if we could split that among the four of us, I don't think we'd have to worry about working again.
Wow.
Then okay, I could concentrate 100% of doing the show and have a show five nights a week. That would be great. I'd love to get back to doing that, but then my day job kind of interferes with it. So if anyone out there you want to hear Bard's Logic five nights a week, give me a sponsorship. I do see, unfortunately, that there is only 10 minutes left, even of the extended version. And so we'll have to start to close things out for tonight. So I want to thank everybody for coming on. Thank you to Ann Murray for coming on to speak with us, and Professor Timothy White. Of course, the panel here, Cindy Todd and Kelly Mordecai. And Mr. Neighbors, James Neighbors, thank you all three coming in and chatting with us tonight. And of course, you, the audience, whether you listen live or listen to the archives, we thank you very much for listening to the show. So, of course, what I'd like to do is give some parting thoughts about tonight's show, starting with, of course, gentlemen. I'm going to defer to the lady first. And then we'll move to James, and then Kelly, and then I'll have to close out the show. So if each person wants to just take a couple minutes, about 2 minutes, go ahead. And we'll start with you, Cindy.
Well, as I stated earlier, I've gotten involved in local politics, and I guess I'll be here for a while. Next election, 2014 coming up, it's going to be just as important as ever. And I'll be still trying to get another couple of Republicans on the county council and trying to get some Republicans in the Senate. We got to get rid of, I have a block on his name because I can't stand the guy, the astronaut. Anyway, we got to get busy, and we have to do state stuff and local stuff and national stuff, and we got to try to get the word out somehow. We got to come up with ideas. We got to brainstorm. We got to figure out what is the best way to combat the strategies of the Democrat Party. And these days it's not just the Democrat Party; it's the rhinos in the Republican Party too. So it's like we have battles from all fronts, and we have to do all of that with less of a budget than we've ever had before. I don't know about y'all, but I've lost 35% of our income is gone in the last 5 years. We have lost 35%.
Wow.
Now, how do you come up with campaign money? How do you come up with the money just to survive when every year you're losing more and more money, So you got to get rid of, and here they are going to raise my property taxes 10%. I can't afford it. I'm living off my savings every summer because that's our slow time of our business. So anyway, it involves is all I can say, and I'm going to try to stay there, and we need to come up with a plan.
And James?
Well, of course, as everybody knows, or if they don't know, that'd be even better. Of course, I'm the founder of Overpasses for Obama's Impeachment / Overpasses for America. And, if you'd like to make a difference in what's going on at the national level, then I would invite you to take a look at us at overpasses.org. We are coming up here on the 28th. We'll be having a nationwide protest, the Patriot Wave 4.0. And at the beginning of the year, we will begin targeting all of the RINOs and the progressive Democrats, which are, of course, progressive. You know, the RINOs are progressive Democrats. That's why we call them RINOs. And we will begin directly targeting them. So if you'd like to join us to help clear a clean house in D.C., we're not just going after Obama. We've got a whole house to clean up in D.C., and so I'd love to see you step up and stand up.
Definitely. Thank you very much, James. And we're going to go ahead and get some links in the not-so-distant future and put them up on the Bard's Logic Political Talk site for those of you who are not yet connected with the overpasses for Obama's impeachment. Then you can access, you'll be soon be able to access the links through the website as well. So go ahead, Kelly, and then I'll proceed to shut things down.
Well, I want to promote a Mike Lelier to come on your show. He's with the Santa Cruz Liberty Forum. Yeah, he's a really neat guy. I had dinner with him and a group, small group, really neat group. A week ago Saturday, I was on a project down there. Anyway, they were talking about their overpasses campaign for Ron Paul. And they were out there in the overpasses. They get a lot of traffic there on the 1 for 101. Anyway, they were doing this years ago. And actually 2012, but somebody was doing the overpasses, and they got the most vote for Ron Paul as a percentage of anywhere in California. So that, you know, there's a tip my hat to James, you know, going national with this. I want to hook you two up because I think that's a real victory story, and I got maybe too much else to talk about. I'll wait for another day, but I really like what James is doing.
Right here.
Awesome. Yeah, definitely. And it is growing. I can tell you. I know it even, it made news here when you guys did it on August 6th. When you guys had the rally there, it made it to, you know, our local news. So it definitely is spreading, and people are getting the word out. And so come back, folks, next week to hear the latest installment of Bard's Logic Political Talk. And that'll be September 25th, and we'll be talking about the defunding Obamacare and stopping Obamacare. So please come and listen to that. And I only literally have just a few minutes left. So please share the archives, share the links to as many folks as you can so they can hear all the information we've had on here with Amy Murray, and help her wherever you can. Even if she's not in your city, it's still important, at least for here, that this city doesn't become another Detroit, and that kind of spread throughout the country. And, of course, she does get a big fight where she's only one of just two or three Republicans who have a chance of getting on to the city council here to have that, get rid of that voter block, or at least be able to bring another voice to the table. And so I will win tonight, as I do every night, and that is with the song by Aubrey Ashburn. And you can hear more of her music at www.aubreyashburn.com. And for folks wondering, no, she does not endorse the show. I just really like her music, and I like it too much. I am willing to share it with other people. And plus, she was on the show some time ago, back in August, actually, of last year. So that was actually a real thrill to me because I've liked her music for some time, and I actually got the chance to talk with her. So thank you again, everyone. Have a great night. Take care, and we will see you again. Good night.
Good night, all.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Good night.
Mm-hmm.